This episode is brought to you by Fangoria. Fangoria is heading into its 40th anniversary this year, and issue number 2 is out to subscribers and hitting specialty shelves on January 23rd. I don't know about you guys, but I got my issue during the break, and it's 100 pages of exclusive, wonderfully curated horror content that honors past, present, and future, and also has a blow-your-own-face-off tutorial for the kiddies. Meanwhile, Fangoria has released a new synthwave album called Holly Doom, featuring the likes of John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and many more. On the literature side, Fangoria is behind 2 novels at the moment, Our Lady of the Inferno and Carnivorous Lunar Activities. Head to Fangoria.com for more details and subscription information. A subscription is $60 and will save you about $20 off the cover price. Again, that's Fangoria.com.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out at www.diabolikdvd.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. Right now on Diabolik, it's Milligan Madness with several Andy Milligan titles never seen before in HD. They also have all the latest releases from Arrow Video, including City of the Living Dead, Strip Nude for Your Killer, and Crimson Peak. And they also have the 3-disc limited edition of Maniac from Blue Underground, which I'm saying is a must-own. So for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to DiabolikDVD.com or find them on Facebook.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also sponsored by IFC Midnight, the leading distributor of genre entertainment in the U.S., responsible for modern-day classics like The Babadook, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, and Ghost Stories. Available now from IFC Midnight is Pledge, the darkly funny Rush Week gore fest that follows 3 friends as they unwittingly stumble upon a frat's deadly serious secret rituals. It's the film responsible for making Dread Central's Zeon Dixon vomit in her cup. Pledge is available in theaters on iTunes and VOD. Also available from IFC is Rust Creek. Lost in the woods and on the run from a group of cruel and sadistic outlaws, an ordinary woman must summon extraordinary courage to survive a nightmare odyssey in this harrowing survival thriller. Part exploitation, part feminist revenge story, Rust Creek is a film that defies expectations. Watch it now in theaters, on iTunes, and on VOD from IFC Midnight. Okay, and welcome to episode 128 of Shockwaves, the first Shockwaves of 2019. One of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Elric Kane.
I'm pleased you survived the new year.
Are you?
Yeah.
Not sarcastic?
You don't sound very pleased, Elric.
I'm genuinely pleased, Rob.
I think it's the cold. It brings out his sarcasm.
I was worried that you wouldn't.
All right. As usual,
I was going to reintroduce, and it's Elric the Plague Kane.
I'm not too bad.
Yeah, but he's firing on all cylinders again tonight.
Yes, because I haven't even gotten to the other hosts yet. So
sarcasm from the top.
Ryan Turek is here.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Rebecca McKendry.
Happy New Year, guys.
Holy smokes. Ernie's here.
Ernie's back.
Happy New Year, Ernie.
And none of us thought he'd come back.
I know. We had a pool going if he would return, but he's here. Thank you.
Ernie's back.
I actually texted him an hour before being like, you know we're recording a show today, right? Thankfully he showed up.
He texted me last week to make sure we weren't Ernie's on the fucking ball, people.
He's on top of it, yeah.
He knows what's going on.
We would fall apart without Ernie. Mm-hmm. But hey, how'd the break go for everybody?
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Took a break, got some sleep.
Yeah.
Watched a lot of stuff.
Me too.
Yeah. I wrote a bunch, finished the movie I was working on. We wrapped post on that for the most part. And started on some new projects. So it is awesome.
I just stayed in my pajamas and watched movies and ignored the outside world.
Jealous.
Elric, you went out of town
for a couple days, but it wasn't relaxing. it really wasn't a relaxing enough break. That's the only problem. But other than that, I can't complain. And I got sick at the end of it. So what are you going to do?
All right.
Yeah. I'm becoming the Rob of the group.
Yeah. You seem quite whiny tonight, Elric.
Discovered a new metal band that I really like.
Oh.
Called Alien Weaponry.
That's a pretty kick-ass title.
I went to see Carpenter Brute at in Hollywood. And it was this band of three guys. They came out. You know, I asked the kiddo, I said, kid.
Because we never asked her name.
No, because I never want to bring up her name.
You sound like
kid.
A blues singer where you're like, I asked the kiddo, I said kid.
I said, are there metalheads in your high school? And she goes, absolutely not. And that,
yep. Wow.
And that really depressed me. So that night we went to go see Carpenter Brut and Alien Weaponry. And these kids stepped out onto stage and they were like 16, 18 years old.
Oh.
And they were like the metal kids that I grew up with.
Yeah.
And they fucking melted my face off. They were really good. Oh. And they admitted that the band name is inspired by District 9.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Alien Weaponry. Yeah. It's really good.
I have encountered this with my undergrads and it's very disheartening. I would say maybe two out of every 100, I would say, yeah, he's a metalhead. Yeah. And then I can talk to him.
Metalhead, but sound off on our Twitter account.
Please.
I want to know that you guys are out there.
Youngins.
High school.
What happened to young kids? Do they not worship Satan anymore?
Christ, go and worship Satan.
Why don't we worship Satan anymore, guys?
Satan's too organized
now. It's really cool.
Satan has a Twitter account now that gets on your handle when you use
Christian
Bale
is thanking him at this point. Satan's gone commercial.
That was pretty good.
Anyways, I know we got a lot to catch up on because we all equally saw a lot of stuff. So
yeah.
Some of it will be the same, maybe.
Yeah, why don't we
a little bit.
I saw Wicked. I don't think you guys saw that one.
No.
Come on, witches, guys, witches. It's actually really cool.
You're talking about the Broadway show?
Yes.
So anyways.
Don't look at me like that, Turek. It was great.
Hey, I worked on Broadway for a while.
It was a fucking blast. I loved it.
So why don't we dive into Netflix stuff? Because I imagine we all delved into good old Netflix.
Sure.
Bird Box. Movie that debuted after we recorded our mm-hmm. top 10.
Mm-hmm.
So the first question, would anyone have put it on their top 10 had we seen it before recording the show?
No.
I deeply enjoyed it, but I would not.
No.
I might have.
Okay.
It might have just edged in.
Mm-hmm. What'd you like about it?
Elric hasn't answered this yet, which means it's
Oh, that's
loaded.
Right. We haven't spoken. I know
Ryan
also is kind of lukewarm about it.
And also let's, you know, kind of note that it's a Sandra Bullock film directed by Suzanne Beer.
Who's big. She comes from Denmark.
She's done a lot of great stuff. And she's tackling an adaptation of I feel like it was a hard adaptation because the book, from what I've gathered, it's very Lovecraftian. And
I haven't read the book.
Oh, okay.
No, but anyone I've heard from people that have read it that it's excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. And Eric Heiserer, who did Arrival, adapted it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So there was a lot of big names behind this adaptation.
And in the book, you never see anything.
You never see anything.
And that's a big part of the book.
Correct.
So it's a big choice when you're making a movie, right? I know that was something they probably went – there's a good interview on the DGA podcast with her where it's about 25 minutes. I sent it to Becca after the FGC.
Was that a dig? That felt like a dig.
Because
I didn't listen to it yet. To,
but it is kind of a dig. But it's a really good interview because she really
– You pulled an Elric.
Yeah.
You didn't listen to him.
But she goes into those big choices and that, yeah, somebody was sketching creatures, and then they're like, but you know, we got to stick to the book. It's a tough one to
do. Yeah, I actually just saw some pictures of them. Designs.
Interesting.
And this bald baby thing.
Yeah.
Bald baby thing. I enjoyed, because there is a point where you kind of get a glimpse of what the creatures may look like when you see some drawings of them in the movie. That's not a spoiler. Mm. But you kind of get a glimpse into at least one character's interpretation of it. And that left me kind of wanting more because they were also vastly different. But I do have to say that regardless of whether or not this film did it completely for me, there was a lot of love for this, including like my parents who'd never sit down and watch horror films, called me up like 3 days after it released and were like, we heard about this movie on CNN, so we watched it and we want to discuss it with you. And I hadn't even seen it yet. And I was like, my parents preempted me to a horror film. This film did something that a lot of horror doesn't do. It like reached masses of people who don't necessarily always
watch
horror.
Which is the same excuse people are using Roma. The Alfonso Cuarón is talking about this movie. He's like, if I'd released this normally, everyone's upset it's not in theaters. He's like, if I'd released this normal, no one would come see it. It's a little film about Mexico, but now it's in everyone's home. So it's the interesting trade-off you get. I thought it was very well directed. I thought it was, I was grabbed from frame one. I was really into the movie. I was very not into where it ended.
That took it down
a couple stars where I was like, eh. But a lot of movies I've seen recently, the endings haven't been great. So I can't be too brutal. I was really into it most of the way. And the set pieces are big and, you know, it's kind of an exciting
movie. And there was genuine tension. Like there was genuine moments where I was sitting on the edge of my seat, like almost with the popcorn in my mouth, just holding it there midair going, ah, like it felt awesome for those moments, but I didn't like where it ended.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm in the love it camp, and I think more because I'm fascinated. I think it's an interesting step towards what maybe Netflix's ultimate goal is. I mean, here's a movie directed by a female filmmaker with one of the biggest female Hollywood stars, mm-hmm. and everybody. I mean, not just horror people, people I went to high school with,
yeah.
your parents.
My parents.
Everybody's talking about it.
It started memes. I'm so old.
Yeah, of course people started out with their stupid comparisons and jokes to The Happening and A Quiet Place, which is like, when I started watching, I was like, have you guys actually watched the movie before you came up with your
creative
joke?
It feels nothing like either.
You're not able to crack wise until you educate yourself. When I saw it, it was like, oh, it's like A Quiet Place. I'm like, it was a book first.
Yes.
A Quiet Place was probably inspired by that.
Yeah. No. Definitely. But no, I liked it. I wonder if, and this is a question for you guys, I liked the narrative choice where basically because a big chunk of it is in a house a la Night of the Living Dead. They're basically kind of redoing that riff.
And I love that stuff.
And I love that stuff
too. That's the
best stuff. But what's interesting is you kind of start the movie and then throughout are sprinkled into present time, which is Sandra Bullock and two kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which means you kind of already know the end.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, do you guys think that I was fine with it? Does that benefit or cloud your enjoyment of the movie, because basically we're seeing a bunch of people in the house that probably aren't going
to
live.
I would love to weigh in on this, because this is an issue that I take. No, I don't know if it's in the book, but it's something that's very popular in storytelling today, which drives me nuts. An escape room, which you'll probably be discussing later on, did this as well, which is open the film with a cold open of something much farther down the line into the film that's going to obviously hook you, that's obviously going to ramp up the tension, that's going to just make you wonder, oh my God, what's happening? And then suddenly go, 3 months prior, or 1 week, 1 week
which
earlier.
Which feels like development note that the film was dragging at the start, so we have to front load it.
I cannot even count how many pitch meetings I've been in where they say, we need a cold open.
Yeah, well, the cold open
is just
fine.
Like a thing now.
A cold open is fine, but as long as it is... It grabs you and brings you into the story, but don't give me something that's going to occur much, much later in the film. And
or a
Bird
cold
Box,
open could be not related to the movie. It could be something tangential.
Yeah, whatever. Listen, there's been a long history of cold opens in a lot of horror films from the 90s and 80s as well.
Slasher
but
films,
But with Bird Box, that was like almost like checkmark one of the things, the kind of grievances I had against it. It was like, okay, great, we're going to meet all these people, and I know that at some point they're all going to go away, because obviously I thought Sandra Bullock's performances were really strong in that first 3 minutes where she's grilling the kids on the rules and what to do and what not to do, and I was like, you know what, I'm emotionally in this already. I don't know what you've been put through, woman, but I feel for you. And then once it was like 1 month earlier, I was like, oh, fuck, everybody she meets is going to be dead, or they've run off into the night, or whatever's going to happen. So I was already disconnected. But, you know, it was just – I mean, my overall feeling is just like I felt like it broke its own rules, or it was unclear about its rules. And after that moment where she's telling the kids, you know, what not to do and what to do, I wanted a sustained moment of tension, which I never got. I felt like the direction kind of sapped the tension out. Yeah.
Now I did. I loved the direction and the tension.
But when she went to the boat with these two children for the first time in a world that you have never been exposed to, didn't you want to feel like, oh my God, there's danger around every corner? Oh my God, I don't know what these things are. I don't know what they're scared of. Because if you look at I rewatched the opening sequence, and it begins with her grabbing the kids by their hands, running off into the woods, and it's a bunch of cuts, and maybe it's like a POV behind the blindfold, and then she's in the boat and she's off. And I was like, I don't know what this world is.
I don't know. There's a couple of set pieces on the water that I really enjoyed. Like
some of it, the kind of River Wild element of it.
That's like why I sent you the podcast, because it's very complex how they filmed that. So I thought you might appreciate that.
Oh,
hey, look, guys, all you need to know at home is Malka Vader's in this mofo, and he's awesome in it. And he may or may not live. We don't know. He happens to be in the house, so if you've been listening along, I guess the whole movie's spoiled. But I totally agree with Ryan. I wasn't bothered by the structure in this particular one, but I think there's a certain point at about the three-quarter mark. I'm not talking about the end, where I think he's dead right, where the tension on the river in that last act is somehow goes away, and it shouldn't. It should be super exciting, like Quiet Place was super exciting at that point. And so I don't know if the structure led to that, but I love the stuff in the house, and I think everyone was well cast.
Well, what else were for you? You're on the positive side. We're kind of on the middling to negative side, I guess. But what else?
I'm on the mid.
I I went along for the ride. I just thought it was interesting and kind of I like the characters and the way that things evolved. I don't know. I just enjoyed the ride. Like I'm one of these people that when I watch a movie, I don't want to guess the ending. I don't want to. Yeah. Pretend like I'm smarter than
I'm like that too.
I just turn off and go for the ride. And so scene by scene basis, and really I think it's because I was just so impressed with how good Sandra Bullock was. Like her performance is so good.
It's a good motherhood film too.
It's a great motherhood film. I really loved basically when everything went. I always love apocalypse begins and you see all the carnage all around. Like Sarah Paulson's got a small kind of role in the beginning, but she's great too. And like the way that whole kind of evolved.
Yeah. It was the acting that I really did love, the actors that they picked for this. And even the night before I watched Bird Box, I had watched another Netflix original, Dumplin', which I absolutely loved. It's not horror in any capacity. It's about a beauty pageant, but I really enjoyed it. And then I was coming off that and the lead actress from Dumplin', Danielle McDonald, I think her name is the other mother in this one. And I was just like, oh my gosh. And Beatty Wong was great in it. There was just a lot of
Moonlight is in there. Yeah. And I think most people, if they haven't watched it, you should all watch it. I think we definitely aren't. I'm definitely not on the negative. I think it's one of the better made films I've seen in a while.
The thing is this, I think it's an amazing feat for a general audience horror movie, meaning like the people that aren't, I liked it. I enjoyed it as it is, but if you're not into horror, I think you'll get a lot out of this movie and find it to be a very thrilling, suspenseful movie because you got a movie star in the front. And it was just easily accessible to everybody.
Except you're probably not listening to our show if you're not really into horror. Yeah.
Plus, Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross score, which is wonderful.
I had no idea he did that.
That's a Trent Reznor score. So that's available now, by the way. My favorite quote about this, which will lead us into our next topic of discussion, is Matt Serafini, who's an author and used to do stuff for Dread Central. He replied on Twitter to Netflix being like, "Hey Netflix, I keep trying to get John Malkovich to shoot the people at the door and it's not working. What am I doing wrong?"
That's awesome.
I think he meant the Black Mirror episode where you could choose what your characters do.
Don't spoil that too much for me. My TV wouldn't work for Black Mirror.
Really?
It literally says your device and it has to be a smart TV. I thought it was. I get Hulu and Google and shit through
how
it.
Elric's gonna adjust the bunny ears on it.
You turn the knob until it gets to 3.
I think we got it in like 92. It's good. It's a good TV. But no, it literally said on Netflix, it was a 2 minutes. I was like, oh, is this film only 2 minutes? Maybe every 2 minutes it changes story. And then it just says, your device. It was a whole trailer saying, your device will not play this. Please, you can call Netflix. And I'm like, what the?
You could probably watch it on your computer.
No, I know I could. I just didn't want to.
Well, then I'll let them take the lead because also did not partake.
Cool. Okay. So try to stay away from the story.
But the reason being, and I just, because everyone's like, you didn't watch and do the whole thing. And it's like, look, I love Black Mirror. I think it's a great show. I have yet to start a single episode in season 4 because every time I watch an episode, I feel so miserable about myself
and
life.
This one will not do that.
That I just don't want to watch it. I can't.
That's what I want.
And so somebody said to me,
San
like,
Junipero.
Oh, here, yeah, that's the best one. Yeah. And then somebody's
God,
like,
San Junipero, I cry my eyes out every time.
So when you tell me there's a brand new Black Mirror and I get to choose what happens, I'm like, nope. I'm not emotionally prepared.
I want to sit on the couch and watch TV. Can I do that?
That's how I am with Black Mirror. Like I was when we were still doing Blumhouse.com and whenever we'd have to watch the new episodes, I would always find other writers to do it because I was like, I'm just going to hate myself for a day.
Yeah.
Like I just,
it's great, but I can't anymore.
Yeah. So this one I wanted to see because I really wanted to see how the choose your own adventure works. Cause I'd seen, kind of choose your own adventure media in past, especially like YouTube's experimented with it. There's a couple other platforms that I'd played around with that were experimenting with it. And it was always kind of clunky and it wasn't anything that felt user friendly. And so I was really intrigued how this one worked. And I have to say, it's fucking flawless. Yeah. Like nothing slows down. It's just flawless. And the episode is not bleak. You can go in, Rob. You will have a good time.
Like, if we want it to be bleak, can we make it bleak?
There's bleak elements to it, and it's definitely got a lot of heavy stuff. Okay. And it gets really meta at one point.
Can you kill a kid?
Yeah, you can kill a couple people. No, that is choices. Like, do you kill this person? Do you not kill this person? And it goes from mundane.
I didn't say person. I said kid, but yes, continue.
I don't think there's children in the entire thing. Fuck it. But no, and it goes from like mundane, like one of the first decisions you get to make, and this isn't a spoiler, he's on the bus and he's putting, because it's set in the 90s, he's putting a tape into his Walkman. And it's like, do you listen to Thompson Twins or there was another one? Tangerine Dream
so it's
or
like
something
little,
like that.
Little choice.
Yeah. Tangerine Dream. Is an option in this that you can listen to.
Yeah.
Yes, it's
and like, so you get to pick, you know, like, and sometimes you'll get to pick what cereal he has for breakfast. And I don't know if you pick Crispix over Frosted Flakes or Sugar Puffs over Frosted Flakes, if it actually makes a difference in the plot.
I bet it does.
But you get to pick tiny things like this, but the Frosted, like I picked Frosted Flakes because fuck Sugar Puffs. And they kept coming back. So like whatever.
What kept coming back?
The Frosted Flakes. Yeah. So like then whenever they would go back to that scene or they would go back through the kitchen or reference breakfast, it would always be Frosted Flakes. And same thing, like I picked Thompson Twins and therefore there was multiple Thompson Twins songs. Same with I picked Tangerine Dream. And so that kept coming up.
It's almost like Facebook algorithm. It's starting to know what you've chosen.
But I'm like, man, if I pick Tangerine Dream, how horribly am I going to kill this character with Tangerine Dream? I just feel all bad options are
inevitable. If you fuck up, it will ask you if you want to go back sometimes. Because I killed him or destroyed his life.
Die?
Yeah.
Oh,
I did it twice. And one time it was like you have the option of like him killing himself. And apparently I chose poorly. You have chosen poorly. And then it will say like, do you wish to go back? And even after I completed the entire thing and made it through, it will ask you if you want to go back and see the alternates.
Yeah. You can go back see all the other major decisions. You'll be asked to like go on a different path if you want to. Mm-hmm. And there's I completed one journey, but then there was a point where I was like, okay, I got things I got to do. So I left and then Ciara finished it up. And there is a good, positive, emotional closure to the end. But there is a kind of more dastardly, sinister version. But
Did you see an article that came out yesterday saying for the people who've done it, think they've done it all, there's one thing that no one actually found yet.
Really? No.
And it was something about a framed photo that you can pick up. And I think Netflix was releasing that info probably to get people to go one more time.
Oh, sure.
Wow.
It's out there.
Interesting experiment.
It's a really cool experiment.
Is the drama good?
It is because the actual plot, and this is not a spoiler, this is in the synopsis, is about a kid. Well, I mean, he's like 19 or 20 in it. He's a video game programmer in the 90s who is making a choose-your-own-adventure video game. And it looks very much like Wolfenstein. If you guys remember that old game where it's like a walk-through maze type thing. But the game is called Bandersnatch. And it's all about his process of creating this. And as he's creating the game, he begins to question if he's in charge of his own reality or if someone else is controlling it for him. Mm-hmm. And that's when it gets really meta because you are actually controlling it for him. And then it goes from there.
I'm all about it. Now, how long does it take to – because somebody
– 90 minutes.
Yeah, took me about an hour and a half, and I did three different endings.
Yeah, to get through it, because you go through the narrative, and I think it's about an hour, and then you've got about 30 extra minutes to just kind of go through all the other
But if somebody wanted to do everything, would it take?
I think it would take like an hour 45.
Oh, okay.
It's not that bad.
Yeah, okay.
David Slade directed it, and they shot like 5 hours worth of footage.
And there's a nod to Slade's previous Black Mirror episode, the one with the
dead, metal dead.
Yeah.
Metal head, that's it. Yeah.
Well, with those things that crawl.
The crawling out of the dog things.
Yeah, it's a video game.
I'm all about it. I'm excited to try it. Looked cool.
I'll think about it.
Yeah, you're in. Now that Tangerine Stream's here, you're here.
I get to pick the score. Wonderful. All righty. Let's go around the room with what we've seen. Ryan, why don't you kick us off?
I will enthusiastically endorse to my dying day a 1983 film called Mausoleum.
Oh, and I saw it too.
I too saw it.
Oh, yeah. All right. Let's go.
One, two, three. Shockwaves approved.
It was okay.
Guys. Okay. So let me
Josh
just
Miller approved.
Let me just explain. Let me explain a little bit of the movie. A little bit of the movie is, I'll try to go through it really quick. It begins
Thank God you're explaining it because I fucking couldn't.
I couldn't tell you what it's about, and I saw it like 3 weeks ago.
It's a little girl at a funeral for her dead mom, and then she gets drawn to a mausoleum at the very beginning of the film. Somehow everything in the cemetery is blue skies, everything's great, but the weather surrounding the mausoleum is stormy and rainy. The little girl starts to approach the mausoleum. The woman that she's with suddenly goes, no! a little girl enters the mausoleum. She gets possessed by some weird demon. As we find out, the demon possession is part of some family lineage in which the firstborn woman in this family becomes possessed for some reason by some unknown demon. So then we cut to little girls all grown up. She's played by the incredibly attractive Bobby Barisi.
Yes.
And then Bobby Barisi suddenly kind of comes online with her demon possession. She creates a lot of havoc for her husband, who looks like William Catt without the really long sweater, with the low-cut sweater.
Mm-hmm.
She hits on the gardener. She hits on...
I have to interject here with the gardener.
Yeah,
After she hits on the gardener, we then get a seven-minute montage of what the gardener does during the day.
Oh,
and it is one of the most amazing sequences.
He's gathering leaves. Uh-huh. He prunes.
I'm watching that thing going, I wish I was in a crowd right now, because this is the most...
It's all metaphor.
It's insane. It's insane. Because at the start, he's totally coming on to her, and then as soon as she kind of reverses it, he's kind of much more sheepish.
I got a lawn to mow, guys. Follow me doing that.
Pretty hilarious, though.
But she basically goes around fucking and killing guys, and she gets glowy eyes. She tries to steal a painting at some point at a mall.
At a mall. She like walks into the art gallery and want this, and then
and
walks
the guy's
out
like,
with it.
Sorry, ma'am, it's already sold. Oh, right. And then she's
she
like...
She has the power to levitate.
She probably levitate people.
And her eyes go cool green. It's pretty awesome.
And then it culminates in this giant explosive demon possession / exorcism thing at the mausoleum. And it is all fucking amazing.
There's
I love this
weird mythology
so
with some crown of thorns that it's like hanging on the door. You can't come in, but then it's
it
like you
got
to put it on the demon.
And
I
then
was
the demon's
confused.
Got like boob faces.
Oh yeah, there's boob faces. The boob faces.
There's some good levitating too.
It looks like oh yeah, that part was
boob
weird.
Boob faces.
There's like the great thing is I just love the feeling of this movie.
Yeah,
we just settled in and watched it like on a rainy day, and it's like a perfect movie for that, where you could just laugh and not scream, because it's not scary at all. It's incredibly campy, incredibly fun. And the kills are great. All of it's practical. It's all in the
John Carl Beekler.
On
the desk.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
There was definitely some good gore.
Really,
effects
really
in
fun.
It.
Stuff.
All right, then maybe I can get on board with an approval.
I think I had fun
I'm
with it.
A 3-star.
It was definitely a fun viewing. So I'll approve it.
I'll approve it too. I had fun the whole time.
I came into 2019 going, I just want Mausoleum to be Shockwave's approved. Yeah.
That was your New Year's resolution. I know.
I'll tell you one thing, that the Vinegar Syndrome version is definitely Shockwave's approved. I wouldn't watch. It's been on Amazon Prime for years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Probably avoid that. So yes, that Vinegar Syndrome.
It looks incredible.
Yeah,
it looks except like it's funny because the opening, I guess because the whatever reel they used to scan, the first couple seconds has a little bit of spots and stuff. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, okay. But within a few minutes, it is like a crystal clear
figure
and like the coloring and everything like that. It looks like an Italian movie and all. But I watched this with Josh Miller, who does Friday Night Frights and loves enjoying questionable cinema with me. And so his commentary is always hilarious. So I agree with Ryan that it is a fun movie to watch with people and just let it go, because bless her husband, he's trying so hard to be like to keep it together and help her.
So hard.
And so there's one moment where he comes home after she's kind of full-fledged embraced this demon thing.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, hi, honey. And Josh just said, he's like, oh, hey, honey, I just had sex with and murdered the gardener. That's all right.
My favorite part is when he brings the painting, she brings the painting home. And then he comes in and she's sleeping, like probably early afternoon, like fresh when he gets out of work. And he's like, no, you can't be sleeping. And then he sees the painting. He's like, what's this? And he's like, what is this? There's something wrong with you. And it's a painting of like some Conan dude, some naked chick and a demon. And she's like, I wanted it. And he's like, ugh. And then he storms downstairs, and the next scene he's like, oh, hey, honey, what's up?
I kind of wish this was the movie they're watching in Mandy, because I think there could be some nice overlap.
Nice crossover.
In the batshitness.
Wow.
But yeah, no, I had a lot of fun watching it too. And I hadn't seen it, so it was cool to see.
Mausoleum, from Vinegar Syndrome.
Yeah.
Let's double down on Vinegar Syndrome, because I also saw Cutting Class.
Oh,
nice.
That's not the one I was going to go.
So
we're
going to
do three.
And I have a Vinegar Syndrome as well.
Oh, my God, look at that. We went all out.
Okay, cool. Let's start with that then.
Let's do Cutting Class.
I had never seen this film before. I know it's well known for having a very young Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Jill Sholin, and Donovan Leitch Jr., who also is in the Blob remake, as the boyfriend in the opening half hour or whatever.
You went deep with that casting.
No, because I recognize
him. No, he's very recognizable.
You look at him, I was like, I know that guy. Yeah. Why do I know him? Like, he's got that.
What is he in the Blob remake?
He's the boyfriend.
The one who gets
the
the
Great Destiny. Yeah. Okay. He's got like a Jason London kind of look to him. That's why I was like, oh, he looks so familiar. So this is a late 80s slasher, sort of. Basically, Jill Sholin's dad is a lawyer who, right in the opening, is off to go on some like extended like hunting trip just to like kick back and relax. And so he's like, I'm leaving you alone for a week. So you don't do anything. You just stay in. What's that?
It's Martin Mull who's playing.
Yeah. So he goes out into the woods and immediately somebody like arrow attacks him. Like, it's just so abrupt to like right in the opening, they're like, oh, that sucks. I guess he's dead and never coming back, but only he's not. I'm not going to spoil that, but the dad comes back repeatedly throughout the course of the movie while all this other stuff is going on, which is basically the Donovan plays Brian Woods, who had a little he had some mental problems and just got out of a mental institution. So now he's back at school and is considered the creepy kid.
And it was for something like cutting the brake wire on his dad's
car.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he does that. Everyone thinks he's a little weird. Brad Pitt doesn't want to be friends with him anymore because, there's something wrong with you, whatever. Brad Pitt is with Jill Sholin's character. Basically somebody is killing people in their high school. And so they set up in traditional 80s slasher fare. It's like kind of a whodunit. Mm-hmm. Like, is it the kid who came out of the institute? Is it the, you know, this far too good looking kid that's
the leering principal?
The leering principal. There's so many options.
And the funny thing is like Donovan's character, because he's at first portrayed as like a love interest. Like, because obviously Jill Sholin's character is like with Brad Pitt, but Donovan's kind of got the hots for Jill Sholin, and Brad Pitt's only just kind of like letting him, you know, pine for her. Mm-hmm. But there are some weird moments where Jill Sholin will like go to a water cooler and Donovan is hiding behind the water cooler and you could see his head through the water.
Yeah, it's like comically amazing.
It's so fucking
weird.
Is it
a horror comedy or just straight slasher?
I think it's supposed to be a straight slasher, but it's hard not to laugh at things like that. The strategically placed creepy boyfriend looking through a water cooler and you see his face in the water.
I feel like there's like a weird gray space between Student Bodies and Scream, and somewhere in the middle you've got Cutting Class.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
It's
now
very, very, very weird.
Oh, and then there's the creepy janitor, and I forgot, the principal's Roddy McDowall.
Yes.
Also creepy.
He's very handsy. He's handsy and leering. Well, it's weird because it's almost like a Me Too slasher movie, because Jill Sholin's just kind of romping around high school and Brad Pitt is Brad Pitt. But every guy that Jill Sholin comes like in contact with, they're just immediately hitting on her or touching her or like eyeballing her or whatever. And you're like, stop what you're doing. What is going on? What message is being said here? And I guess that is because Rosbo Pallenberg directed it. He was the writer of Excalibur and Emerald Forest. Weird. And this was his, like, I think it was directorial debut.
It was, yeah.
And it was like his kind of sly way of setting up red herrings and knocking them down.
And it's also the only thing he directed, by the way. But no, I'm sorry. Right, I mean, he wrote he wrote Excalibur.
Let's not bury the lead. He was the second unit director on a little movie.
Deliverance.
No, Exorcist 2.
Oh, Exorcist 2 as well. Yeah, uncredited writer as well.
Were you surprised? 2. I mean, I hadn't seen this movie since my Blockbuster days.
I had never seen it. So and to me, it was a pure gem.
Was it a surprise to you that Brad Pitt is really the star of the movie? Like, this is, he eats up a lot of screen time.
Yes, because I thought his name was one of those, hey, he's like the third character in, and we're just going to capitalize on him. And I'm like, no, he's the lead. And not only that, but he chews up all the scenery.
He does.
And he's actually pretty good.
Oh, he's really good, yeah.
Yeah, like, you could tell, like, just his physical acting, like, the way he, like, touches and does things kind of like in, you know, eating an apple and like, being quirky or whatever. And you're like, oh, I could totally see why this dude became a star. Like, you can kind of see it from early on. And he's pretty ridiculously, like, too good looking for this whole cast. And you're like, he's going to be.
Wait, not Jill. Jill's beautiful.
Yeah, Jill's pretty beautiful.
It's Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Did you watch the Jill interview?
I watched a little bit of that, but I went to the other guy, Donovan, because I was just curious.
Got it. Yeah, Jill did not like speak highly of the movie.
Yeah, definitely not.
Yeah.
But Cutting Class, and I mean, again, Vinegar Syndrome put this out. It looked amazing.
Yeah.
Which it's just like it blows my mind that these movies
look as good as they are.
And they wouldn't have looked that good on screen.
Yeah.
They probably wouldn't have.
By the way, if I can tell a quick side story. So one of the movies, I'm not going to talk about this film, but our good friend Jeff Nelson from Scream Factory, he called me up randomly on New Year's Eve. And he's like, hey, do you want to watch New Year's Evil today? And I'm like, yes, I absolutely do. So he came over to watch it. And I have a 65-inch HDTV. My couch is about, I don't know, 10 feet away. So the way, you know, Elric's been over and, you know, the way it's positioned, it's like these movies, like the ones we're talking about, in that setup, that big, that close, just look better than they probably ever looked in the theater. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just unbelievable. And basically the whole time, Jeff just kept asking, he's like, God, this looks so good. He's like, how big is this TV? How far back is your couch from there? And by the end of it, like the next day, he's like, I started looking into a 65-inch TV. I'm gonna get the whole thing. Nice. And I'm like, look, man, you only live once. If you want to see New Year's Evil and Cutting Class perfectly, I think you need to have
this.
He's got to
get it. Jeff, if you're listening, you got to get it before that Cruising Blu-ray.
Yeah. Because
I know you're holding out.
Need it for that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that film will look brilliant.
And then I was going to say, the Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray also has a uncut and cut scene comparison.
Oh, I didn't
notice
that. As a
special feature. So you can go through all of the kill sequences and see it, and it's uncut and cut glory. But I mean, like, the version that we have that you're going to watch is uncut, so you just get to see what the censors want to chop out.
Awesome.
One of the Vinegar Syndrome titles I saw, which I'd never seen, is The Children. I'd never seen The Children.
Okay. All right.
This is the British one?
No, that's American.
New York. This is Troma released this originally.
Oh,
but it's not a Troma.
I'm thinking
like
of the British kids in the woods in the middle
from like
of winter
the last 10
with
years
the cold.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the recent. This was, I mean, again, this is another one that looks great. I think there's a couple scenes that they couldn't restore, so they're still in there. And this came out the same time as Mausoleum in terms of the release.
Yeah.
This got made the exact same time, I guess, as right after Friday 13th. So it's the same locations.
Wow.
And I'm pretty sure there's a couple actors who cross over. It's on one hand, it's terribly directed in parts. There's parts where people will leave a scene and the camera will stay in the scene and keep going long after characters exit. And you're watching, and I mean every dramatic scene.
Dramatic pausing.
Yeah, I watched it with Dick and we looked at each other like, Jesus Christ, like, why is it to pad out this movie? But all the horror stuff in it, I got to say, I liked it actually ultimately, maybe more than Mausoleum, only because the image – okay, so it opens with a bus of kids kind of coinciding with a little – it's not a nuclear plant, but it's some sort of radioactive power plant.
Nuclear plant right
there. Okay, nuclear plant. It does open with that. Very Homer Simpson. It goes in there. You don't see what happens to them, but you do know there's a cop comes across an empty bus. And he's like, wait, where are all the kids? Where's the driver? And everyone's like, it's probably fine. Don't worry about it. And as the kids start showing up, they basically go up to their loved ones. They look really kind of creepy, but not too creepy.
Yeah.
They want to hug them, and when they hold them, the fucking person starts going full street trash and like exploding with like dust and particles coming out, and it's really fun.
Why were the kids taking a field trip to the nuclear plant?
They were passing it. It just happened to be bad timing.
Okay.
But it becomes actually kind of emotional because, you know, it is everyone's loved one. So even when they fear the worst, like that could happen to them, but when that kid puts out their arms, you kind of want to hug them. And so it really – the horror scenes all work, but there's a section towards the end with a kid in peril where they go there. One of those scenes where you go, holy shit, they go there. And I really, really liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun. And if only somebody could do a trimmed down edit of the actual drama. There's also a totally surreal scene where somebody goes to tell someone, yeah, your kid's missing. And one guy's you're going to love this scene so much. One guy's a bodybuilder and it's like surrealist almost. It's meant to be natural, but he's just like working out and he's, you know, classic bodybuilder guy. I can't remember what he's lifting, but it's something fucking goofy and he's wearing a speedo. Yeah, this guy, it's a speedo and the other girl and the other lady's topless
right
and has no problem with the cop being there and they are so disinterested in their kid ever returning. So it had little touches like that make no sense.
Amazing.
And the extras are pretty interesting, talking about these people who never made another film. So
that's
one of my favorite. Way back in Killer POV days we did with Cinefamily, we did that episode about regional horror filmmaking.
Oh, right.
And this is that kind – this was probably on that list that they showed. It's that kind of movie. And so even its flaws, like noticing the camera keeps – you know, shots keep lingering, it make it kind of charming. But I think that and Mausoleum are actually a really nice kind of double. And
I've never seen this. I'm going to watch it now. But
it's fun.
All I I knew about is, oh, that's the movie where kids can kill you by hugging you, and the only way to stop them is to chop their hands off.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't want to ruin that, but that's one of the greatest moments I've seen in a movie this year when that first happens.
All right. Well, sorry if I spoiled it.
Yeah, it's all right, because you still won't know when it's coming.
That makes me want to see it more.
Yeah, I'm kind of just on the sales pitch from Rob.
If you don't buy it, I'll bring it in. But that one I really liked. I got to say.
All right, The Children, 1980s. Children.
And you have one Vinegar Syndrome.
I do. Continuing the Vinegar Syndrome love, I watched Terror. Now, they had talked about this one when Vinegar Syndrome came on our show a couple of episodes back, and this is the one that they called the British Suspiria.
Yes.
It's from 1974, and I can definitely see why you would call it the British Suspiria.
Because it's a witch movie, right?
Suspiria, it is not. Let me get that out. Suspiria, it is not.
Did you watch the interview with the director?
No.
All right, it's on the disc, and the first thing he says, so I went to see Suspiria, and I was like, I could do this.
So yeah, I looked that up while I was watching it, because you watch it, and you go, oh yeah, he did. He definitely watched Suspiria, because it has like some of the scenes feel exactly the same. It's got the crazy green and red lighting. The blood is super hyper color. It's really misty. There's a lot of dream logic going on. There's actually a scene where a plate of glass comes down and bifurcates somebody's head.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And it's about witches. So it definitely feels Suspiria. Mm. It still paced like a British horror film from the 70s.
And I mean, this is like 82 minutes. So when you feel the pace, you're like, oh man.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's some pacing there. There's some fun to it. So it is about, it opens with a witch execution where a woman is being put on trial for witchcraft and they kill the shit out of her. And then we fast forward 200 years.
But wait, that's a movie of what happened.
So
that's kind of, it's one of those openings where it's like, and we pull back and there's a set and everything's like, oh no, we're shooting a movie about this.
It really happened. And then we find out that the guy who owns the movie theater or the movie studio, it's about two guys own a movie studio and all the other characters either work at the studio or are actresses there. Yeah. So it's supposed to be about the glitz and glam of like show business in Britain, but it's a really tiny studio and most of what they shoot seems to be softcore porn. But there's this like grand dame actress that comes in and everybody's auditioning and things like that. So it's kind of set in this like show business backdrop. So one of the guys who owns the studio then reveals that the story, this witch movie that they were shooting, is about his relatives, who's the woman who she supposedly cursed the entire family, and the actual giant freaking knife that killed her is hanging right up there on the wall. And then we fast forward a little bit to everybody from the studio and all the actresses and everything are at a party, and this one guy is like, I'm going to start hypnotizing people. And he hypnotizes one girl, and she wakes up, and and then this other girl does it, and she goes nuts, pulls the knife off the wall, and slashes at some guy. And then it's like, oh my gosh, she was possessed with the witch. And then for a little bit, it turns into what you think is a slasher film where people around her start dying and you're supposed to think for a real hot minute that she might be doing it. And then it goes full supernatural and you realize that the witch is coming back. It does have one absolutely awesome sequence that I really liked where one of the guys is in the film's storage room by himself and the film literally starts attacking him. And it was just a really cool sequence with just, I don't even know how they did it, but by far, I mean, like there was some gory segments to it, but the film scene was, which was not gory at all. It was just a dude being attacked by film, was really tight. It definitely feels...
The British Suspiria, baby. Yeah.
British Suspiria.
That's enough right there.
Terror. Yeah.
The guy who directed this, Norman Warren, did a ton of other horror films like Bloody New Year and Inseminoid and Prey and things like that.
Oh, I still haven't seen Prey. I need to see that one.
Yeah. So this one, apparently he was planning a sequel and never got there. But
no Inferno ripoff.
It's fun. If you're a horror completist, you should definitely check this out. Or if you really like Suspiria, because you can watch it and go, oh, I see what he did there. Like, he literally watched Suspiria and
said... It's a bad title for it, though. You know, it doesn't make me want to watch it because there's so many terror-oriented titles. So it's
Yeah, and they're, I think they just... So this is Terror from 1978, but they just announced...
78, thank you.
They're doing one of his movies called Bloody New Year. Uh-huh. They announced that over the break.
Cool. I bought that right away.
They already put out Prey, I think.
They're doubling down on Norman J. Warren. Big time.
Yeah. Wow.
We thank you, Vinegar Syndrome, yes, for all that viewing, because that was some fun stuff.
That yeah. was, yeah. That
I
was,
would have
yeah.
never watched Terror had somebody not, one, made a very fancy, nice-looking copy of it, and then told me it was the British Suspiria. So well done, Vinegar
Syndrome.
And
that's definitely my best run of Vinegar Syndrome. Good ones in a row where I'm like, oh, yeah. I liked both of those. Yeah. That's rare.
Yeah.
A lot more hit and miss usually. So.
Yeah. No, we're doing a lot of hits now.
Did you do any big ones, the big new films?
Yeah. Yeah. Before we get to one of the big ones, I want to just say that I got a chance to buy 88 Films' Blu-ray UK release of Nightmare Beach.
The one where, I love it.
You love this
but
one.
I haven't even seen a Blu-ray. I saw the shitty Amazon Prime a while back.
Oh, the Blu-ray is gorgeous. It's such but a cool I don't know how this one passed me because it just checks all sorts of boxes.
I just
boxes
don't think it was
me.
Very easy to find here because I'd never heard of it until
no one's released
on.
It over
You
here.
Also got Murder Rock. Which
I did, which
is
I'm gonna
so fucking cool.
Which we will be watching very soon. Nightmare Beach is basically about a biker who was framed for murder, and he was wrongfully executed. And then during spring break, someone's going around
in America.
Spring break.
They will emphasize in their
break,
Italian
spring,
way.
Spring break in Florida, of all places. Yeah. It's Lindsay doing Florida, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
But he almost captures Florida pretty perfectly.
It actually kind of does, and he has the football kind of ex-football player quarterback. And there's a lot I like. On
I mean,
the
if you
stuff.
Look at like Spring Breakers, and you look at Nightmare Beach,
I think that's a shared universe.
I think
it's in there.
But I think that like Nightmare Beach is much more true to the Spring Break in Florida vibe. But basically, it's about it follows this guy who the woman who works at a restaurant, and basically they're trying to get to the bottom of who's killing all these spring breakers.
But how are they dying?
And they're dying by way of a mad motorcyclist who will either A, drag you to his motorcycle so you could touch the handlebar and you get electrocuted.
What?
Or he'll just electrocute you in the face.
But it's literally an electric chair
on a
motorcycle. How does he ride the motorcycle?
You're riding bitch. You're riding on the back.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I mean, you got to get there.
And it has the best cover art ever with that mat. I mean, and there's just a lot. It's just fun.
A lot of fun.
I feel like you could pair it with what's the Warner archive one? Night School.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
Helmeted Killers.
There you go.
I like them both.
That's a fun night.
And Wraith.
But what I like, you got Michael Parks, you got John Saxon.
Oh.
You've got a biker gang called the Demons.
Oh, that's right. They're
using the exact same font as the Demons movie.
Nice.
That looks like it's taped on from I'm looking at a photo of the jacket. It looks
they're
like
stickers.
They cut the logo out from a poster.
Yeah. You've got
taped it to his leather jacket.
Yeah. And it's just you get a whole wide range of characters. He sets up all of these different characters for you to kind of follow. Ultimately, they wind up getting killed, from the kind of textbook misogynist who you want to see from the second he calls somebody a lezzy, and you're just like, wow, you got to go down, motherfucker, to this one goofball who's introduced by laying face down in a pool with a scar on his neck, and everybody thinks he's dead.
The practical joker,
and he just keeps showing up as a dead body, and you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's really bad.
It's just got this weird late 80s charm.
You know what actually reminds me most of is probably Pieces, in a way. Like, you know, the enjoyment you get from a Pieces. Yeah. It's not quite as ridiculous as that, but it does have that same kind of This Is America by Way of Italy. Though it definitely was shot here for real. It definitely felt like it was actually shot in Florida for real. Which Pieces was not, I'm sure, shot in America. But I totally back you up. I have to get the Blu-ray of this too, because I really enjoyed
Beach.
It.
Nightmare Beach. Yeah.
88 Films. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
You mentioned big ones. Did you see Escape Room as well?
I did not. I stayed retro.
Yep. I did.
You see?
One other new one, too.
Jump in Escape Room.
Why don't you cover yours and we'll cover the three.
Sure. Well, then I'll go quick on these. I doubled down on some Abel Ferrara this week, break.
I saw that on your letterbox.
I picked up The Addiction from Arrow a while ago. I know Elric talked about it.
One of my favorite releases
I love
of the
that
year.
Movie yeah. so much.
I'd never seen it. It's one of his that I'd never seen. And I just popped in this Blu-ray and was – because, you know, you can get Driller Killer Ferrara, but then you can also get
Classy Art House.
Bad Lieutenant. Yeah. Like, you never know.
I like Driller Killer Ferrara.
Yeah, like
I'm questionable on that. But but The Addiction blew me away. Yeah, I just thought, first of all, it's a black and white film. He did it right after Body Snatchers. And it's gorgeous. Mm. It is just, it's one of those Blu-rays where when you see it in black and white and high def, it's just gorgeous. And it's basically a vampire tale in New York City a la you know, Larry Fessenden's Habit,
yeah,
things similar of that ilk. And it's also, I love it because it's the New York that I grew up in knowing. It's New York 95. And so a lot of it takes place in the streets there. And basically Lily Taylor is the lead who runs into her best friend is
From Sopranos,
Edie Falco. Falco. Yeah. And then Annabella Sciorra ends up basically they kind of bump into each other in an alleyway and Annabella feeds on her because she's a vampire. And so now Lily Taylor is kind of readjusting and readapting to becoming a vampire in New York 95. And then there's a great scene where the great Christopher Walken comes in.
I mean, he's explosive. The thing that's funniest about that, I started like 10 years ago and on back on PCP when we were doing our movies that should be on Blu-ray. This was like my number one. Recently talking about it, but I saw the film 10 years ago.
Oh, gotcha.
When I saw it again, the thing that surprised me is that Walken's in like one sequence. In my mind, was in
the whole movie
because it's such a great performance.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, what scene stealing is all about. You just are that explosive and interesting. You know?
So good. And if you like those kind of vampires, movies that kind of have that art house edge to them and also capture a part of New York that just doesn't exist anymore. This is one of his best films. The Arrow release is spectacular. There's a ton of bonus features, but I know Elric, you talked about it when you watched it. There's one, it's considered a short film by Abel Ferrara, but basically it's him going to Christopher Walken's house, Lily Taylor's house in like snowy New York. And just asking them about not just the movie, but just about addiction in general. Yeah. And it's like very candid because the stuff with Walken is hilarious because basically the first time you see him is they're just pulled up into his driveway and he's like, yeah, just, you know, pull in and, you know, you guys could come in. And they're just shooting the shit for a few minutes on camera. And somewhere along the lines that they get into the topic of Philip Seymour Hoffman and talking about, he's like, oh, I worked with him. He was great. I didn't see the addiction there, whatever. Yeah. So I thought that was really.
Yeah, so he said he wouldn't even touch a glass of wine.
Yeah. He's like, you would never have seen it.
It was
coming. So shocking.
Unless you knew him behind. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also, I found that to be really beautiful. And also that it's quite mysterious because Nicholas St. John was his co-writer on all his major films. Like, besides, what's her name?
Miss 45.
But I always get
Zoe
Lund. Because she had two names.
Yeah.
But Nicholas St. John did, you know, he did this. He did Bad Lieutenant. He did Bulk, and you can never see an interview or anything with this guy because I guess at a certain point he found God, like kind of went into the opposite direction.
Right.
But they talk about how the ending. For some people, it could be this pessimistic ending. And there's Abel Ferrara is like shooting down the academics who have their
thing. Yeah.
He's like, no, it doesn't fucking mean that. What's wrong with you? What do you think? And he just kind of said, and it's like
character.
So Ferrara. It's great.
Yeah, I
think it's such a good disc.
If you've never seen it, The Addicted, and even though it's an hour release, I think it says that it's Region B, but
I watched it here. I don't have
it played on my regular player, no problem.
Did Ferrara talk about Zoe Lund on there?
I don't know.
Because she died of a heroin overdose. She was a heroin advocate, which I didn't even know was a thing, but I was like obsessed with her when I lived in New York, like hunted down her old apartment and everything. She bred rats, and you can still get her rats in New York.
I don't know if he did, but he did. The surprising part, because in my mind, he was always an addict young.
Yeah.
He didn't try it till he was like 45 or something, and then he was like for 15 years as a total addict, and now I'm off.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like you just realize how kind of shocking this could be.
Yeah. No, I don't know. There's plenty of stuff to still go through. I haven't picked up the Miss 45 disc, which I think would probably
it's gorgeous.
Have a lot of stuff on there. But because I was in the mood and I saw that, I was like, you know what? I bought Body Snatchers. I remember Ryan talked about it last year.
I like that
film. I'm going to pop it in. Now, there's been a dozen Invasion of the Body Snatchers movies over the years. I think this is one of the best.
It's really solid.
I forgot how goddamn good this movie
was. Dark.
And
it's
dark.
Very dark.
And, again, this is early 1994 or whatever. And so it's kind of a spiritual, even though it's a few years apart, it's spiritually in line with like the Blob remake from the late 80s, where just a great cast, the whole military setting. I think Larry Cohen was the first writer on it, but the final credit goes to Stuart Gordon and his writing part.
Really?
Like, if you look, it says screenplay by Stuart Gordon and Dennis Paola.
Dennis Paola.
So I was like, oh, wow, they wrote this. We're used to it now because of Stranger Things and everything trying to copy, but in even like the new Strangers movie with the what I call the Stephen King font slowly going to frame. What I love is the opening of this is a great piece of score with that Body Snatchers just coming down for like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You're just in space with the logo as it slowly pans out. And then like some of the letters start copying each other and stuff. And you're just like, oh man, I forgot the tone of this. Also, it's under 90 minutes. So it's like a lean, mean reinterpretation of Body Snatchers.
Yeah. Is that on Blu-ray?
That's on Blu-ray through Warner Archive. Yeah, I'd love to hear that. So yeah, that double, I don't know if you're going to get better than those two movies.
Also, the idea of him making bigger movies is weird. Like, the idea of him having bigger canvas to paint on is such a bummer when these, like, they seem probably quite dangerous, I imagine, to studios, directors like this. But they take their job seriously and they make good movies. So it's, you know.
I thought the effects in Body Snatchers were what really.
They're great.
They are great. Yeah. Up to the point where you almost see it on one fully recreating their clone and way they did it. Yeah, it's pretty terrific. If you haven't seen it in a while, definitely check it out.
I need to rewatch Addiction because I haven't seen it for a really long time. There was actually a period in the late 90s, or I guess that one came out in like 95, 96?
95, yeah.
And there was definitely, I was working at a video store at the time, but there was like a period when I was in high school where I was determined Lily Taylor was going to take over the world, and she was like my favorite actress because she did The Addiction, I Shot Andy Warhol, and Four Rooms.
She
like,
was the
back
biggest
to back.
The actor in that
at that
movie.
Time. Yeah.
And then she did like The Haunting.
I loved her in that. And yeah,
You're going to love it. It's going to resonate more with you now because it's actually an attack on academia. And so when it goes into the thing with all the academics, you're going to laugh your ass off because I think it's hilarious. It's like a total attack. So the big ones, eh? You want to jump on that one?
Yeah. So Escape Room?
Escape Room.
Man, I'll tell you what. I was very surprised entertained I found the Escape Room. I mean, it's awesome because we happened to like Adam, but I was going into that one thinking, oh, God, I've seen all these saws, dragging my feet.
Well, I mean, like, there were two Escape Room movies that probably came out on VOD prior, but it was like, okay, what is Adam and the writing team going to bring to this experience that makes it feel like you need to see it in the theater and it's big on a big screen and makes it feel theatrical?
The set pieces are
so
rad.
Cool.
Yeah.
There was one.
The sets
my
were
palms
rad.
Got sweaty.
Oh, yeah.
My
yeah.
palms genuinely got sweaty. There was one sequence. It's in the trailer. It's like an upside down room. I'm not going to tell you what happens in it, but I don't like fucking heights.
See, mine was the cold one. That's when I was like, I don't like the cold.
It's a fun movie. It's just like Robitel keeps the pacing going. Mm-hmm. I feel like he's like a good thriller action director.
And the characters, I actually liked the characters. And what's the name of the actress from Daredevil?
Oh, Debra Ann Wall.
I thought she was fantastic and animates the whole movie with kind of a surprising energy. Because at the start, you're meeting the characters. I was going, oh God, stock characters. And then she came in. And then all those, even they seem like stock characters, they did get some life and some backstory. Mm-hmm. There's some key information that you find out, obviously, and we definitely won't spoil it here, about like why these people. And I think really adds to the story and made it like a really unique film. I was genuinely surprised. It's one of the most entertaining ones I've seen in a while of just the set pieces. Again, kind of like a Bird Box. I didn't love the multiplication, again, where it kind of lands, but I was able to pretty quickly forgive that. I didn't hate it. I was just like, oh, yeah, that's the ending. But you could have just, I got to be careful with this because I think a lot of people wouldn't have seen it yet. I put it, if I was ranking it in my Saw movies, I put it above everything past two.
Yeah.
I like Saw 1 and 2, and then I like this. And then, so that's how I'm putting
it
up.
No, this one, it was really fun. I enjoyed the puzzles. I'm hoping that they do a sequel because I was all in, like when they get these little clues and how they're figuring them out, and I was cheering for the characters and just everything. And they used a Petula Clark song, and that's awesome.
Yeah, it was funny sitting next to a Escape Room fanatic in Ciara because she does these very regularly.
Did you go with Kara?
No, Ciara.
Ciara.
Yeah. Kara should have been there, too.
I know.
But because they're two peas in a pod when it comes to Escape Rooms. But what was interesting was, you know, I've done my fair share, and we were both sitting there going, okay, you need to walk in, you need to look at the padlocks. Call out how many padlocks there are. What do you need? A key to this? And then we were like, they're not communicating enough. What's going on? Oh, this is so frustrating. Because the communication would, like, only last so long before the character drama started coming to the fore, and they all just started bickering with each other.
Yeah.
We're like, you're never going to get out of this room.
I think it's also because they had secrets, because they'd see things in the room that were like about them, so they wouldn't say it out loud. So it's a little more nuanced.
It was cool.
I thought I was not going to like that one, but I was going to love Hellfest, and it was the opposite. So I watched Hellfest last night, and I was very excited to see Hellfest. I have been since it came out, just because it like just looked really cool. It looked glossy. It looked like a straight slasher, which I feel like we haven't seen in a long time, and it is. But to the point for me, I mean, it looks nice. It's nice and glossy. To the point of redundancy, I thought it has an opening kill. We were talking about scenes and movies. That is like the least imaginative kill I've seen in the last 10 years. And you're like, and it's the opening of the movie. And it's just like, stab, die credit. And I was like, what? Like, I couldn't even believe, especially compared to what song you guys put out last year?
Happy Death Day.
And then thinking about like what Craven does at the opening of Scream, going like, set pieces are so important to how you, and that was not a set piece.
Especially slasher movies.
Yeah, slasher movies. And as the movie goes, I really dislike the characters. I just, you know, basically nothing about it, you know, besides the setting was really working. I will say, in the, from about the middle on, the deaths get pretty gory, and I actually really enjoyed a lot of the death scenes. They still weren't shot in a way that felt like sequences, but the actual gore were really cool. But I was really shocked that it was a reverse. I think Escape Room is wildly entertaining, and I thought this was quite flat. That said, this would play well during that season, like when you're about to go out for Halloween. Now it's a little late, but I think if this comes out, watch it next year, right before you go out to one of the parks. But it just, the characters, everything kind of feels flat to me on that one.
Well, I brought the kid with us, and she was disappointed that because Bex, what's her name? Bex Taylor?
Bex Taylor from
Scream. From Scream Show. She was just disappointed because she leaned over. She was like, oh my God, Bex is in this.
Yeah.
And then she was like, oh, Bex is playing straight. And I was like, that is a weird decision to have.
You know what? It is exactly like the Scream TV show minus the self-referential cleverness of the characters, which is actually a big minus when we're at this stage. You know, you can do a straight slasher, but because they're so kind of clueless in this, you're like, you're behind the TV show.
Right.
And the TV show is a little more creative.
Right.
So I was disappointed by that.
Because we're on the topic. Did you see Hellfest?
I did not. I loved Escape Room.
I was going to say, because we're on the topic of amusement parks, Becca, I'm about halfway through Fantasticland.
Is it not fucking amazing, Ryan?
It is. I want to reserve everything, but it's highly disturbing. It's a highly disturbing novel because I do not like crowds whipped into tizzies and then full-on massacres occurring.
Oh, yeah.
Because I do not like fellow man. That concerns me. If I'm ever caught in a situation where it's like an amusement park getting hit by a hurricane and everybody's losing their shit, I do not want to be there.
A lot of people have read it, though, because of you. I mean, I've seen more
tweets
to that. Yeah.
My dad is reading it.
I'm so glad. No, that's one. It was recommended to me by Kyle Clark from the This Is Rad podcast, who knows I'm kind of an avid reader and will read just about anything people hand me. And he literally gave it to me, I think at trivia one night, and was like, you need to read this. Yeah. And I read it in a weekend and just loved it. Well, thank you for finally reading it.
Of course.
Speaking of reading, so I read a graphic novel for this week. I read Glitter Bomb, which is from Image Comics and written by Jim Zud and I'm going to mispronounce this name, Jabril Morissette Fawn. I hope I didn't slaughter that. But I really enjoyed this one. It is about a middle-aged actress who was on some type of, we'll call it Star Trek-ish sci-fi show when she was younger. And everyone remembers her from that. But that was 20 years ago, and she's now in her 40s, and she can't get work, and she's auditioning for these tiny roles, and she's losing the parts to younger people. And she can't, she's single mom, she can't afford the babysitter, and her life is just falling apart. Her agent doesn't want her anymore because she's not hot. And one day after a really bad audition, she goes and sits on the beach and something kind of pulls her into the water.
Yeah.
And then she kind of pops back out and is like, well, that was fucking weird. And then a couple of minutes later, she realizes that she's like, there's a creature living inside her that eats people. And it gets real Lovecraftian.
Yeah.
And then at that point, she kind of starts taking control of her life. You start realizing that the people that she was on this Star Trek, the sci-fi show with, like one was kind of sexually aggressive. Some of them were real assholes. And everybody looks back at it with this like amazing nostalgia. But she looks back at it with like a, no, you guys were fucking terrible. And it goes from there. And I read the entire first volume in one sitting because I liked it so much. And I just ordered the second one tonight. Or
yesterday. I could have done with, I thought it was a one-off. So I read the first collection and I was like, okay, cool, I'm good.
Yeah,
I thought it was just like it was just gonna pay off in like one full arc, but I haven't read anything beyond that, so I'm very curious to see where
I just
it goes.
Ordered the second volume. So I'll let you know, but I really enjoyed the first one. It's a blast, and it did have it was one of the truer portrayals of, you know, being a kind of struggling actress in Hollywood, especially an aged one.
Yeah.
I say aged 40. She's a whole 40 in it, and everybody's like, you're too old. So there you go. But so Glitter Bomb was really, really cool.
Did you watch? I'm just curious because I remember you were trying to see it before the end, before making like our year list. Did you see House That Jack Built in the end?
No.
Okay.
No.
I did see that one.
Yeah.
Didn't quite make my 10 list. For Von Trier fans, they're all going to like it.
Yeah.
Because it's got his dark sense of humor, but this is maybe the darkest yet.
Yeah.
The set pieces with Matt Dillon are like amazing. He's incredible in this film. Like it sucks that people aren't talking about him because the film is so grim that I think it's too much for most people and it's a little too long. But he is fantastic, and each one of his set pieces is with a woman. It's totally about misogyny. Every single sequence is about this guy who's killing women. He's a serial killer. But then the part of the movie that is either working for you or doesn't work for you, and it's the part that means this movie is a little too long for me, is he's also – throughout the film, there's a descent to hell that is happening. Most of it's like over black and voiceover, and but it's also comparing his – serial killing to the films that Von Trier has been making his career. And so it's a weird – there's one scene where you actually see clips of his films. So that part just took me up. Where I was like, wait a minute, Lars. And I love his films. Even when they don't quite work, I tend to have fun. This is still fun.
Yeah.
It's, again, like most movies this year, it's too long.
Yeah.
But I think for a certain fan, they're going to love it. I could see why this could be a classic case of love or hate, not somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
But there is one scene in it that has been the one that's created a lot of walkouts and a lot of people not being able with kids that people can't handle.
Right.
But I found those parts to be quite funny. So it just goes to show. I think Uma Thurman, she's in like she's the opening victim, and she's fucking hilarious. She's like, he picks her up and she goes, oh, I shouldn't have gone in the car with you. You're probably a serial killer. And he's like, what? And she's almost like trying to convince him that he's a serial killer. Right. And it's just really fun. And I think what sucks is when a conversation steers towards, oh, he's a misogynist versus – no, this movie is so clearly about it.
Yeah.
You can tell because of the roles all the women get are really smart. Unfortunately, they're hanging out with the serial killer. Mm-hmm. So it's you know, obviously Von Trier is some guy who actually does work through things in his movie. So he might really be a misogynist, but he's at least man enough to put it in his work to go, oh, am I?
Yeah.
And so I think that's interesting about his work. So I think for some people, I think if you haven't liked his other films, there's probably very low chance that this one's going to roll for you because it's pretty fucked up. But if you like Antichrist, Antichrist is one of the few that doesn't have much of that humor,
mm-hmm.
even though I really like Antichrist. It's this at least has that to get you through some of the really violent things.
I'll check it out.
And I didn't see the unrated one, and it was still violent as fuck. The unrated's maybe another couple minutes, the director's cut, but it's stuff that got edited out in America.
Huh.
I'll also give a super quick plug. On Christmas Eve, Rob Elric and I went to the New Bev and saw Die Hard.
We forgot it was so long ago.
Yeah, I know. It was forever ago. And the second film that we watched after Die Hard was one called The Silent Partner, which is not horror, but I will call it Hitchcockian as fuck.
And in the middle, towards the end, there's a scene worthy of Argento.
Yes.
So
one of the greatest on-screen kills.
Really? Like a Tenebrae-like, where you're like, holy Jesus.
So,
I couldn't believe it when I saw it.
Yeah, don't go in expecting like a True and Blue horror film, but there's a lot in that film that genre fans will like, and it's one that I'd never seen before, I'd never heard of, but I've been recommending it like crazy.
Well, I recommend it to you because of the Christmas thing, and him and Brian have been talking about Brian.
We've been talking, because you know why? Because first of all, it's on DVD, but the cover's terrible because they make it look like some sort of heist film or whatever from like one of these like, you know, Seven Psychopaths or something. It's not that at all. It's Elliot Gould versus Christopher Plummer in probably his most sinister role that you've ever seen. But the beautiful thing, they've been showing it at the New Bev with Die Hard every year. That's how I saw it. Immediately after our screening, Kino Lorber announced a Blu-ray.
Yeah, it was like the next day.
Yeah, like literally, I was like, oh, finally. It's one of my top Elliot Gould performances next to like The Long Goodbye, those two movies.
And he's so weird in it because he has no personality in it, but all the women are like, oh, you are so hot. You're like, it's Gould. He's being Gouldy.
Yeah. Just wait. So, Christopher Plummer, man.
Yeah.
But no, that definitely has enough of a horror crossover in the middle that people should see it.
Yeah, and that is The Silent Partner.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to make it I'm going to reveal something about myself that I did not know.
I know where this is going.
I'm just trying to look at my computer.
I'm trying to find out.
I told Rob G. I was like, I'm going to admit this to you. So I bought a double feature UK collection of When a Stranger Calls and When a Stranger Calls Back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've lived my life thinking I know what A Stranger Calls is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Carol Kane. It's, you know, the killer's inside the house and da-da-da-da. So I sat down. The first day of my break, and I was like, I'm going to do a double feature. This is going to be amazing. Can't wait to revisit these movies. I mean, at least the first one. So I sit down, I watch When a Stranger Calls, and then the entire opening sequence, which is like 20 minutes, 25 minutes long, plays out, and Carol Kane is like, oh my God, the killer's inside the house. And I was like, oh my God. And then all of a sudden it becomes Charles Durning's movie, and it's about many years later, mm-hmm. the killer who was inside Carol Kane's house is now, he's an escapee, and Charles Durning is after him, and he's trying to track down this guy. And I was like, I have never seen When a Stranger Calls, ever.
Yeah.
I've only seen the first 15, 20 minutes.
I feel like that happens to a lot of us for horror.
It's so fucking weird. Yeah. So anyways, When a Stranger Calls is okay. It's okay. It's a little draggy, and there's some really interesting things. I think the stuff that's truly terrifying is, you know, when Charles Durning is giving the lowdown on what this killer has done, and he's like, well, how did he kill the kids in the house? And he's like, oh, he did it with his bare hands. He tore these kids apart with his bare hands. And I was like, oh, my God. And then it kind of comes back around to Carol Kane. When a Stranger Calls Back, which is the sequel that was made for Showtime.
I think so. You know, like 10 years later.
Yeah, 10 years later. So I settled in for that. And it's Jill Sholin doing the Carol Kane bit at the very beginning. But there's a little mix-up. It's a little different. A little different this time of what happens in that house. And obviously she's traumatized by the experience, and we cut to however many years later, and now Jill Sholin's like rocking a mullet for some reason, and that's our guest calling, so I'm going to take that.
To be continued.
Yeah.
But I'll talk
be right
about
back.
This
you could talk about it. Yeah.
So this is actually a great release. It's all region. It's region free, but I got it from Amazon UK. And it's from a company called Second Sight that's been doing a lot of cool releases. But it comes in like a giant box with When a Stranger Calls, When a Stranger Calls Back, the original short film. I think it's called The Sitter that inspired.
Oh, wow.
Which I haven't even watched yet. And a pretty thick little booklet about the whole thing. So this is almost like an Arrow level box container or whatever.
You guys had already recommended this one.
The soundtrack CD is in it too.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, this is kind of a.
I mean, that was one of my favorite things. I forgot to put on my. I would have actually put that on my discovery list for Pearson. I totally forgot about it when it came to do that list. But that first 20 minutes, like you guys said, I loved that. Mm-hmm. And then I actually really liked the movie too. We'll never know if Ryan liked it. We didn't quite get to that part before he disappeared.
It's gone forever.
We'll just have to assume that it's PCP approved probably right now, and we'll move up from there. I mean, or Shockwaves approved. I don't even know what show I'm on. I'm like the stepfather here.
I have a sneaky suspicion it's going to be Shockwaves approved.
I would think so, at least the second one.
But you know what? Here he is. He's back.
So is the second one Shockwaves approved, Ryan? We didn't know. You left us
thumbs
hanging.
Thumbs up or thumbs down, quickly. He's coming back.
He's running back.
So what I was saying is...
What were you saying?
You think it's like normal, like a normal When a Stranger Calls movie.
Part two. Yes, okay.
But there are so many unique and bizarre twists that I actually just want to remake...
Two?
The second half of When a Stranger Calls Back.
Yeah.
The second half. But honestly, the beginning of the movie...
That's perfect.
Because Jill Sholin is traumatized when she goes and meets the cops because she suspects someone's breaking into her house and messing with her shit. There's a moment where she's sitting down with these detectives, and it's just these three very macho-looking guys sitting around a table, and little timid Jill Sholin with her baggy denim and her bad mullet, and then... Everybody's like, well, ma'am, what are you doing? What's happening in your house? And she explains everything. And they all just look at her with like this incredulous like gaze. And Carol Kane comes in and she's like, I believe you. And you're like, fuck yeah, Carol Kane.
Yep.
I want to see a Carol Kane series where she just coaches final girls.
Oh, man.
Where she like experiences When a Stranger Calls.
Wait, isn't that the new Halloween? Isn't that the entire plot of your
Listen,
film?
We can still go thematically
Ryan,
wherever
we
want.
You have the power here, sir.
But what's interesting is that, you know, it's interesting to see Kevin Williamson took a little nod from When a Stranger Calls Back because...
A little?
Well, I don't know who takes the credit for Sydney working for a women's crisis center in part three, but that's what Jill Sholin's character does in this.
Yeah.
But there's just really interesting stuff. And what's interesting about the When a Stranger Calls movies is they slow drip so much information. Like it's just really well done and slow dripping information. Like in the first one, it was like, oh my gosh, who's this guy that we're just following around? Oh my God, that's the killer.
Yeah.
Okay, why is the killer out? Oh, he escaped. Okay, what happened to these kids that he killed? We don't find out what happens until 50 minutes into the movie where Durning's like, he tore them apart with his bare hands. And you're like, holy crap. So When a Stranger Calls Back does the exact same thing. It just slow drips information and it's going to give it to you when it's ready. And I think it's really rewarding. I love the two movies together, watching them back to back. It was a great experience.
Yeah.
Even though I think I favor When a Stranger Calls Back more than the first one.
I do too.
But I like the vibe of the first one.
The second one feels like Fred Walton was literally thinking about what he did wrong in the first one for 10 years and was like, you know what, if I could do it again, and then that opportunity presented itself and then just knocked it out of the park with that sequel.
Yeah. Anyways, good stuff. But that's a lot.
Excellent.
We watched a lot.
It is. And we should – there's other things, but we should just hold on to some of them for next week because we have a great guest. And we should just get right to
it. All right. So we're going to bring on our guest.
After you hear our sponsored messages.
Yes. This episode is brought to you by Fangoria. Fangoria is heading into its 40th anniversary this year, and issue number 2 is out to subscribers and hitting specialty shelves on January 23rd. I don't know about you guys, but I got my issue during the break, and it's 100 pages of exclusive, wonderfully curated horror content that honors past, present, and future, and also has a blow-your-own-face-off tutorial for the kiddies. Meanwhile, Fangoria has released a new synthwave album called Holly Doom, featuring the likes of John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and many more. On the literature side, Fangoria is behind 2 novels at the moment, Our Lady of the Inferno and Carnivorous Lunar Activities. Head to Fangoria.com for more details and subscription information. A subscription is $60 and will save you about $20 off the cover price. Again, that's Fangoria.com.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out at www.diabolikdvd.com. They're the #1 source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. Right now on Diabolik, it's Milligan Madness with several Andy Milligan titles never seen before in HD. They also have all the latest releases from Arrow Video, including City of the Living Dead, Strip Nude for Your Killer, and Crimson Peak. And they also have the 3-disc limited edition of Maniac from Blue Underground, which I'm saying is a must-own. So for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to DiabolikDVD.com or find them on Facebook.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also sponsored by IFC Midnight, the leading distributor of genre entertainment in the U.S., responsible for modern-day classics like The Babadook, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, and Ghost Stories. Available now from IFC Midnight is Pledge, the darkly funny Rush Week gore fest that follows 3 friends as they unwittingly stumble upon a frat's deadly serious secret rituals. It's the film responsible for making Dread Central's Zeon Dixon vomit in her cup. Pledge is available in theaters on iTunes and VOD. Also available from IFC is Rust Creek. Lost in the woods and on the run from a group of cruel and sadistic outlaws, an ordinary woman must summon extraordinary courage to survive a nightmare odyssey in this harrowing survival thriller. Part exploitation, part feminist revenge story, Rust Creek is a film that defies expectations. Watch it now in theaters, on iTunes, and on VOD from IFC Midnight.
Okay, so about a year ago, I was not in the office. I was in South Carolina, and I was super bummed because you had 2 guests on at the start of the year. One was Mr. Adam Robitel, who we were talking about earlier, who just did Escape Room. But you also had Lynn Shea, who is our guest for the evening.
Yeah.
And I wanted to bring Lynn back because I've never just sat down and picked Lynn's brain about her wide-ranging career. If you put a picture of her up on social media, people go, oh, that's the lady from Critters, or oh, she was in Nightmare on Elm Street, or oh, and or Something About Mary. She has been in every single thing I think I've ever seen, and I thought it was high time to bring Lynn in to have a career retrospective conversation. So Lynn, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you, and I hope it's just the beginning.
Well, there is a
My favorite expression. I hope I'm never over, and it's never over until I'm ready.
Well, there is a Renaissance going on.
Yeah, Renaissance.
I like that.
You know, I mean, you know, I think thanks to the Insidious franchise.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
I will say, when I post a picture with Lynn, it is a very popular picture, especially
with
people I grew up with, because they recognize you and like, oh, he's friends with her. That's nice.
It always gets an, aw, I love her. Yeah. Like, it's always
you were
the
universally
response.
Loved.
Yes.
You know, it's really like smoke and mirrors, I swear, honest to God, because I never had a plan at all about anything. And I it really sometimes feels like it's someone else's life. Because there has been so much, and I must say it's been really a fabulous ride so far, and I really do mean that. I hope it is just the beginning.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so many places I want to still explore, in both interior and exterior, so story-wise and philosophically and, you know, support-wise for people who look to the arts, especially for ideas and for support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot more I want to give. So,
were the arts always supported in your household growing up?
Yeah, very. That's a great question, because my mother was a housewife and my father was a lawyer. He graduated from law school at 21 years old. My mother came from Russia at 13 years old. Wow. She didn't speak a word of English. She and her mom came alone because her father had died. They actually were Tsarist Russians. My mother was born in 1913. So they were a wealthy Russian family, and then the Bolsheviks came in, and their lives changed dramatically. I mean, the stories that I remember my mom had, that the army captains moved into their house and sort of moved the whole family into one room. She had three brothers and a sister. By the time she came to the United States, her father and one of her brothers died of the flu epidemic.
Mm.
Wow. Speaking of which, you should all get your shots.
Got it.
Too late.
They're out everywhere in anyway. L.A.
Yeah, you. There's no excuse. And one of the other brothers had heat stroke. He was in the Army. Those are the stories I remember. So when she came here, they put her in first grade. At 13 years old, she said she couldn't even get her knees under the desk. She was... And you can imagine for a 13-year-old little girl going through puberty to be put in a room with six-year-olds, mm-hmm. basically. Mm. And she had an ear. I mean, it feels to me like she could have been a musician. She learned English. So she came at 13. By 17 years old, she graduated high school with honors. She spoke perfect English. She never had a trace of a Russian accent.
Wow.
Ever. I mean, it's crazy. And so she was a personality, a big personality. She was very sure of herself. I was never – I'm digressing here, or kind of running around in different places.
Okay.
But the whole thing about women right now with girl power and women power, that never meant anything to me, because I never felt any – I didn't ever feel inferior. My mother was a person, and she always made me feel there was nothing I couldn't do if I tried and I did a good job, you know, and I worked hard. Right. There was no difference between what I was allowed to do and what my brother was allowed to do. She was a little more cautious about me going out by myself, but I was also 5 years younger than my brother. Mm-hmm. And so I'm almost sort of puzzled and annoyed, but maybe that's not very nice of me to say, but I go, well, of course. And you know that we're not the same in the marketplace. Well, that has nothing, that has to do with economics and with, you know, people playing the game of who's on top, basically. And so it's very recognizable that women have been suppressed, certainly. But in my life, I never felt that, mm-hmm. ever. So, which I guess is a true gift, because I didn't have my balls cut off. I mean, or maybe I grew some. I'm not even sure. But I mean, I was never afraid to be. I was very shy, but I was never afraid, which is kind of a different, kind of a funny mix. So, yeah. My mother, in a way, was an artist, because she loved music, and she didn't play an instrument, but she was very theatrical in her expression. She was very vocal about her ideas and her opinion about things. And my dad, who again was a lawyer, and he did other things. He was also kind of a financial advisor for a while, which I don't know what that was all about because I was younger. But he started painting when he was in his 50s. Mm-hmm. He decided to take an art class.
Yeah.
So my mom and him went. She went to one, and that was it. He took all the paper and paint she bought, and he became a fairly well-known Michigan artist. Wow. And actually, my agent, Gina's my manager, yeah. Julia Buchwald, there was an auction in Michigan. This was just a few years ago, and she bought 8 of his pieces.
Oh, wow.
There's, I think she has a couple oil paintings and some silk screens, and he was wonderful. So my mom, I feel like whatever chutzpah, that word, which we all know whether you're Jewish or not, I got from my mom. And from my dad, I got also, you can do this. You know, that it doesn't matter. Gender was never discussed. Isn't that crazy? I mean, it really, when I think about it, it is crazy. So I feel a little bit like a boy sometimes. I'm not gay. I mean, I have nothing against being gay, but I'm not that interested in women physically. but I have a boy inside of me. There's some part of me that's very, and it's not tomboy. It's some fabric of, I hate to say self-belief, but I think men have been allowed to believe in themselves more than women have in our society. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the problem is societal, more than anything. And I guess I was very lucky.
Yeah. It sounds like you just had good insulation.
And good role models.
Yeah.
My mom was very artistic in the way she put her home together, flowers. She loved arranging flowers, all of that kind of thing. So I loved both of them so much, and I'm so grateful to have been their daughter.
Yeah. And who brought cinema into your house? Was it your brother? I mean,
well, that's Bob. Yeah. It was pretty much Bob, because Bob started. He was very interested in photography when he was around 11 and 12 years old, and this was also rare. My parents built him a little dark room in our basement.
Oh, wow! That is
and
nice.
he had a camera, and he entered some contests, and. So his first in high school, he was the resident photographer for headshots for the girls. So they used to come over. Well, I don't know what went on in our basement.
Amazing.
But Bob had one of those big white rollers where you roll out, you know, so you have a background. For, and the girls would come over, and they were all with real pointy bras and cashmere sweaters from high school. And I know all their names. I won't say them because I think Bob's still friends with some of them. So he was very popular with his photography. And did some beautiful, really beautiful work. And he would develop all his own pictures. So, you know, that's what it was at that point. There was no iPhone and there was no, right. You know, edit, Snapchat, Mitch, whatever. I'm sorry, I really am old school about all that. He and I was the agitator. They put me in this little tiny, the dark room was all of about, what, like 3 feet by 2 feet. It was tiny. And we had all the chemicals in trays, and it was fabulous. And he had an enlarger, he'd put the image on. You'd see, he'd play with the image a little bit, and then it would be a blank piece of paper still, and you'd put it in the different chemicals, and you'd see the image start to appear. Mm-hmm. It was like magic. Yeah. And I was the agitator, because you had to like keep moving the fluid over the picture for about 10 minutes or something. So he would stick me in there and have me do all the agitating. And then he decided in high school, this was in high school, he made his first film called Will Fondue Do. Uh-huh. and before that, actually, he did this other, he did a little film, God, I even remember this girl's name, Martina Allgaier, this beautiful girl, and he did a study. It was like a both live action and photo of a girl where you couldn't tell which was real. Hmm. And it's owned by the Museum of Modern Art or it's owned by a museum that bought it. Hmm. And it's called Image. And that was the very first thing I think artistically I remember him doing.
Wow.
Except dressing up and scaring the shit out of me. Literally where you'd hear a bang and I'd walk into his room and he'd be lying on the floor in a pool of ketchup. He actually did that. So the horror, us going into the horror roots. I'm talking too much.
No, not at all.
Great. That's what you're here for.
It's not our retrospective. Okay.
Yeah. Elric will just gab on. Right. Yeah.
To go back to his first movie. So Will Fondue Do was shot in our living room, and he built a dolly, I remember. And so film was always in his mind, I guess. And then Bob is a brilliant person. I mean, really, really, I don't think people know how smart he is. Some of the things he's written are exquisite. And my father, too, was a fantastic writer. Mm. Mm. And so was my mom, actually. I lost my train of thought. He went to Columbia Law School. He graduated from University of Michigan, went to Columbia Law School.
Was he trying to follow in your father's steps?
I think it was like my dad said, that's what he should do. And, you know, it was always get your teaching certificate, you know, just in case and have something good to fall back on. And then he got, a Fulbright scholarship. Mm-hmm. And went to Sweden. He was in Sweden. It was either 1 year or 2 years. And it was there he made a film called Walpurgisnacht, which is Crystal Night. It's actually Crystal Night. First he did also this thing called Night of the Witches, I think, which was about in Sweden they do this whole – there's some midnight thing, which I don't know exactly what it's called. I think it's called Night of the Witches. Mm-hmm. And he photographed it, so it was a documentary. And he figured stuff out as he went, and when he did the Fulbright, that was when he really, you know, got more, I think, into the idea of business plus film.
Yeah.
And when he came back, the beginning of New Line Cinema is a great little story. I don't know if he told you it or not.
No. But where were you during this time where he was going through school? I mean, were you kind of following an arts career, or what did you want to do?
I didn't. You know, my dad said get a teaching certificate. I didn't really care so much about that. I was always I grew up a loner. Totally, there were no kids in my neighborhood. This is a testament to no. Can I say the bad word?
Absolutely.
No. Fucking
want.
Cell phones. I'm so sick of that shit. And I'm sick that people, they know that stunts creativity because the kid is not using their own image, and they give them to, babies are walking around with this radiation, all over themselves, right? I'm very down on all the technology. I love that the convenience it's provided in many respects, but I think it's really changed. It's going to change everything when we don't even know what is changing.
It won't be our lifetime.
It's in process.
Yeah.
But when I grew up, when I was around 5 and 6, I had one girlfriend in school. I remember my best friend, Sandra Sandwise was my best friend. And then a little girl moved in next door to me. And actually, I just found her, which is crazy too. But so she moved in next door. She had two sisters, and she was my age, and we just fell in love. I mean, I don't think we spent one night either, not at her house or at my house, sleeping. It was all sleepovers. We'd have sleepovers. But what we would do when I was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, so Bob was like 11, maybe 11, 12. We would make up stories. We would act out stories with all my dolls and my animals. We wrote a neighborhood newspaper complete with comic strip and a gossip column for the animals and the people. I mean, it was so creative and so much fun. And we did drawings. And we made doll clothes and we sewed stuff. And we had this game we used to play. It was we would make notes, write notes. Go to the top of the stairs, look for what's under the hairs. There'd be a doll at the top of the stairs, and there'd be a note in the hair of the doll. And so we would have these treasure hunts.
Yeah.
And then we'd have thread. When you get to a certain place, it's like, pick up the spool, don't be a fool. and you have to follow the thread. And we would put the thread literally all over the house around my father if he was reading the newspaper. You know, and it was really the most incredibly creative time. I mean, it was so much fun. We colored a lot. We drew. It was definitely a very, very creative, creative atmosphere. And my mom was totally into all of it. You know, don't get dirty and don't put the thing on the thing and don't do the thing. It's like, whatever, then pick it up. She was very supportive without even being conscious of it, I think, of how much she nurtured in all of us creatively. So I was always in plays. I loved pretending to be somebody else. I still do. and I'm not sure why. I remember it felt like I could walk into someone else's life. And I still have a little bit of that working on it is now more methodical and, you know, sort of more clinical, if you will, you know, like figuring out stuff. But there's that moment of entering another person that I still have a feeling of and for. And so I was in the first Thanksgiving play and I got sick. And I remember I couldn't go. I had one line. That was off. And later on, I had a lot of one lines too. And then, you know, whatever play was in, I wanted to audition for it. And I often didn't get the part. Finally, in high school, so grade school, was just grade school up till eighth grade. And then high school, I was in the drama club and in the Radio Broadcasters Guild. And I would actually give the Monday morning news announcements over the PA. And there was this girl, her name was Chiquita Klinkscale. I couldn't get her name right. And I remember broadcast over the whole school. I mean, there I am going, I'm totally cracking up. And actually, the whole school started to laugh. I mean, it was this, I'll never forget that. It was one of these incredible moments because you could hear, it started out just on the microphone like this.
Yeah.
And then you could hear other people and then all the classrooms, like everybody sort of erupted in laughter. And I got a kick out of that, being in charge of people laughing like that. That was my a real taste of comedy, of enjoying comedy. Making other people laugh is – there's nothing like that, really. And – or cry, both.
Yeah.
So – and so I remember we did I Remember Mama, and I auditioned for Dagmar, and Linda Cole got it. And I was a much better actress than her. And if she's around – sorry, baby. But I got – and so I had the little part. And I usually got the little parts. I didn't ever really get the big parts. And – when I graduated high school and I went to U of M, I was not a theater major. I was an art history major. But again, I was always auditioning for everything. And I was in musicals wherever I didn't have to sing because I'm not a singer. But we did – there was an organization called Musket. And we did The Boyfriend and Wonderful Town. And I just found the program from Wonderful Town, actually.
Yeah.
And they had like a theater lab, and I was always auditioning for stuff. And then I graduated from Michigan, and I sort of did my classic runaway to Europe for a year, telling my parents I was going to try to get into the Courtauld Institute of Art in London. Are you kidding me? And they supported me. I mean, they gave me money. I didn't have any. I wasn't working. And they gave me money to go. And that whole year of my life was insane. But I ended up in England. You really want to hear all this?
Oh, yeah. What happened?
What happened in England?
Well, the first night I was there, I had no idea where to go. I ended up checking into a YWCA. And but before I did that, I literally had two giant bags of luggage, and I got off the bus, and I went out to Piccadilly Circus to one of those little Fordhams, and I sat down, and this guy sits down next to me, and he's kind of looking at me, and he said, are you American? And I said, yeah. And he said, are you looking for a job? And I said, sure. Can you imagine doing that today?
Yeah.
And he said, here, call this number at 6 o'clock tonight. Here's the phone number. Ask for Keith and tell him George told you to call. We're poets and we're going to the Edinburgh Festival and we're looking for a secretary. So I said, okay.
Yeah. Wow.
So
this got real sketchy.
Wait a minute. Really? I'm like a rabbit. I mean, it's like, okay. So literally, I remember I didn't even have any English money. So at 6 o'clock, I called the number and asked for Keith, and he answered the phone, and I hear this sort of guy, he's kind of had an Australian English accent. And he said, George told me you'd be calling. Can you come tomorrow at 10 a.m. to my flat, and we'd like to interview you? I said, sure. It was all on the up and up. This guy's name was George Whiteman, and the other writer, His name is Keith Harrison, who ended up also being my niece's teacher at Carleton College 30 years later. Oh, wow. I mean, it was insane. He was like this little Australian guy with a red beard. And
they really were poets going
to Edinburgh. They were really poets.
I was waiting for you to show up, and he had his pants off.
The pants were on. The pants were on. It was all legit. We went to Edinburgh. I met William Burroughs. It was at the Travis Theater Festival with Jim Haynes, who I think is still there. The whole thing was 100% on the up and up. I met Robert Lowell. I mean, it was this incredible. I felt like I'd been shot out of a cannon. And then from there, one of their friends, this woman who came with us and who was a real organized English woman, young woman, she was all of 21 years old also, but she was running a theater company. So I ended up getting a job with her on a little theater on the West End as their prop mistress.
Wow.
And they were doing this sketch comedy thing, and there was the thing where birds were supposed to fall on these people's heads. So I don't know what possessed me, but I went to a butcher shop.
Oh, my God.
And I got all these dead bird heads that I could, instead of like making something out of paper, and they started smelling.
Oh, my God.
And literally, I mean, so I got fired. And, so again, I was rubbing shoulders with theater, you know, and with creative people and who were giving me a lot of, feedback and, support, basically. And when I came back from England, I got my first job at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in the registrar's office, because after all, I was an art history major. And I kept thinking, geez, when am I going to get to be in a play? You know, and now I was, there I was in New York, and I thought, well, wait a minute. Well, maybe I could be an actress. And I swear to God, that was the first time it dawned on me that I could have a, you know, do that.
Yeah.
So I applied to 3 graduate schools in theater. I applied to Brandeis, which I did not get into, and NYU and Columbia, which I both got into. And I went to Columbia. And so I was there for 3 years in theater, and it was exquisite. I mean, we were there, this was 68 through 71, basically. Off Broadway was just getting started. It was the most magnificent time. I was always doing something. Always. Chelsea Theater Center, American Place Theater, Playwrights Horizons, the Manhattan Theater Club, oh my God, it was just endless. The WPA. These are all became major big theaters later. And I got my Equity card finally at a 5-hour performance of The Screens at the Chelsea Theater Center. Robert Kalfin was the artistic director, a really nice guy. I had one line as I played an Arab.
Oh, my God.
And I had one line, which was husband. One word, I guess I should say. But it's The Screens was written by Jean Genet. It's a 5-hour production. And with a dinner break. Yeah. And there was a fabulous role of a character named Layla, who is the ugliest girl in the world. And the whole production, she has a burlap bag on her head. And I wanted that part so badly. I remember the audition. They were blown away, but they gave the part to this other actress. And I was asked if I wanted to understudy. So I said, sure. And that was how I got my Equity card, because there were 10 hours of theater on the weekend. Yeah. You know, it was an Equity show. So her name was Janet League, a beautiful, beautiful girl who played the role of Layla. And so she generously said, if you want to do, you know, I mean, she needed the break too, but she said, if you want to do the performances, you know, on the matinees. So that was, I played the ugliest girl in the world. That was my first real Equity theater.
Huh.
And here I am, still playing the ugliest girl in the world.
Well, feature film-wise, Elric wanted to just dive right in.
Yeah, like your first role.
Oh, I'm sorry.
First
role ever is credited as whore.
Yes.
But it's okay, because it's in a Joan Micklyn Silver film, and she's one of the great underrated woman directors,
I think.
Chilly Scenes of Winter is, I'd have another show, and that's like one of our favorite movies, period.
And so. You were talking about Carol Kane, who actually was the star. That's a great story, too. She, I loved the script. I mean, I thought it was a beautiful story, and I was really – I think she knew Bob. I think that was through
– Had you auditioned for movies before getting this first role?
No.
This is like your first
– It was really – I had done a little program on WGBH, actually with Piper Laurie.
Mm. Mm. Oh, wow.
That was my first real role. She played Margaret Sanger. And I play an immigrant woman who is dying in childbirth and who had – because I tried to abort myself. And it's really the story. It's a turning point in Margaret Sanger's life. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing I did. I think I auditioned for Joan, and I think I knew her through Bob because he knew her husband who was, I think, in real estate possibly, but he was financing the film. So, and it was the part of this prostitute, and it was a really nice story. The story was basically that, you know, she meets Stephen Keats's character, and God rest his soul, wherever he may be. He kind of comes in, and they do the thing, and she pretty much says to him, "The reason that I'm a prostitute is I can make a dollar a day rather than 5 cents a day in the sweatshops, and I'm trying to bring my family over from Poland." So the idea that she was a prostitute to finance bringing her family. And it had a really nice – there was a nice little kind of monologues almost. And so we shot it and everything. I was really excited because this was my first movie. And so I called my parents to come to the premiere, and they came to New York, and we file into the theater, and we watched the film, and Joan, she didn't say anything to me. The whole other scene was missing, the whole explanation. So it was just really this one scene where you kind of see my breast as I'm leaning forward, and I'm sort of sitting next to my mother, and I'm kind of like, I didn't tell her that part. And my mother was very, very ladylike in that way. And I'm sure I could feel her react a little bit. And she was kind of waiting for the payoff, and there wasn't one.
Yeah, bummer.
Okay, so we get to the end of the movie, and everyone was really happy and loved the film. And I'm excited to see my name on screen, you know, because I'd never seen that before. And they run the credits, and sure enough, the very last thing it says, Lynn Shay, whore. And my mother stood up.
Oh, no.
I could feel her. She like rose. She didn't even stand up. She rose out of her seat. She marched up the aisle, and I kind of went after her, marched right into the ladies' room and threw up.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Visceral reaction. Wow.
Wow.
So that was my first wow. movie role, and I will never take it off my IMDb.
Hester Street.
Yeah. Yeah. What was what were the moments after when your mother came out? I mean, like, did she have
I don't remember
words,
too much.
Yeah.
No, not really.
Yeah.
She was appalled.
Yeah.
You know, if it had said Lynn Shay prostitute, or they'd given me a name, you know, you know, Julie the prostitute,
wow. Yeah,
Becky the prostitute. I don't.
Well, you can't put that on a business card, Lynn Shay Moore. Right.
That's Lynn Shay Moore.
It just doesn't work.
No, that you can. You can't.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
But your mom did see you in many other things, right?
Yes, she did. But I really think my mother. My mother didn't love that I was being an actress because it was always like she wanted me to look pretty, and that was never been my thing. I mean, you know, my mother was a true lady because she had come from nothing. You know, well, that's not true because when she, I guess, was young in Russia, she was, you know, pampered quite a bit, but she was very ladylike, but she had a She also was bawdy. She was really this really rough, kind of funny, great sense of humor, dirty. I mean, you know, really, you know, for that time of in the world, women, you know, were sort of not supposed to be that. They were supposed to be ladylike. You know, the country club was the big deal. You know, we were kind of upper middle class, and I hated all of it. I hated that stupid place, and I hated all those people.
That's why you joined the circus, like a lot of actors. This is the circus.
Sort of. I mean, on some level. I mean, I was always, you know, I don't know what that is. I still don't really understand it.
Yeah.
But it's a part of your fabric.
Yeah.
I like the dirty side of life. I'm interested in that.
Because that's life, I think. Like, the dirty side is where life resides, and that,
yeah,
the unpredictable, yeah, stuff.
There's the horror. I mean, yeah, you know, and we all got it in us. Literally and figuratively.
did that one role, though, like, her reaction was to rise out of her seat and be upset. What was your reaction seeing yourself on screen for the first time? Like, oh, yeah, I like this. Like, even though there's disappointment, was there also that feeling like, I want to do more of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the disappointment, I was overridden. The disappointment overrode, yeah, everything. First of all, because my mother's reaction, but also because the scene that I was really, yeah, hoping to be in there wasn't there. But oh my God, I do. I have so many crazy stories. I found some notebooks. This was just a couple days ago. I started going through my closet. You really don't remember your life. I mean, I found stuff I wrote. I have no idea. If someone had showed it to me and said, who wrote this, I would have no idea. Yeah. And but I was desperate. Once I finished school, I mean, I was at Columbia, I loved it so much, and I was really good. I was, yeah, really good at it, and I knew that, and I got a lot of reward from my teachers, and actually Jack Gelber was one of our teachers. Mm. We had fabulous guests. Joe Papp was my teacher. Mm. I mean, I, you know, did stuff I played Doreen and Tartuffe at the New York Shakespeare, mm, Festival.
Nice.
Which is probably, I could never learn those words again, but it was, I got a lot of reassurance from people about my talent. And I don't say it with any ego. I think it is somewhat separate from me, because sometimes stuff, it's very emotional. I don't know where it comes from. Hmm. And my job is to, you know, it sounds corny, but is to open up that place and trust it and just to tell the story that I feel that erupts in me. I mean, it really is like an eruption, because there's a handful of times where I can really say I barely remember it happening. And yet I'm got all the lines, my blocking's right, I'm doing everything right, but there's some channel. That's a real thing. It's energy. There's an energy core that I cherish in myself. And I really find it extremely important to protect. And I'm very protective of it. And as I've gotten older, don't anybody fuck with me. I mean, about that. I'm willing to talk about anything and everything and make changes. But when I really, really know that there's something going on that you know, even if you don't use it, you got to let me do it, because it's usually the gold. I feel so fortunate.
And where do you feel like that's come out? Like in what parts?
In places,
or yeah, yeah.
Oh, and sometimes odd stuff. I'm trying to think if I don't know if I can give you real examples. Because sometimes it's just a moment that you feel in a I try and let it come as much as possible, and that's also with choice of parts. There's moments in Insidious. Hmm. There's a couple moments in there. Actually, in the most recent one, there's and it's beautifully written. It also comes from the writer. Lee Whannell is an exquisite writer.
Yeah.
I mean, I learn his words like I do Shakespeare, and he expects you to. I mean, I love him for that. We actually had not an argument, but I kept saying night instead of dark at one point. There was some little mile, and finally he's playing specs. He's in the scene, and finally he stops and he says, Lynn, it's not night, it's dark. And I said, well, I knew it was. I just kept getting it wrong. And he said, I pick my words very carefully. I said, I know that. You know, all right, whatever. But I know, I love him to pieces. I love him to pieces, but he writes beautifully. I tell him he writes in Australian,
yeah,
because there's a cadence to what, yeah, he creates in dialogue and in character that's, I think, really quite phenomenal. Yeah. So it's if the writing is there. I actually just did this really crazy little movie in Oregon called Get Gone. That he's a hiker. This guy, his name is Michael Daniel. I'm happy. He'll be happy to know I got his name. And he had never made a movie. And he wrote this script, and it's kind of about this family who lives on land that's being taken away from them and being used for chemical, you know, like fracking. And their children are born fucked up.
Yeah.
I mean, fucked up. Mm. and they're fucked up because they've been eating that food and drinking that water. And this is a guy who's never really written anything, but I really thought the writing was terrific. And there's plenty of holes. There was stuff that wasn't there, and I'm now actually I just saw a cut of it. It's pretty good. Mm-hmm. It's kind of it's got a B movie feel, with almost like a caricature of a feel. Mm-hmm. But there's some stuff in there that's really smart. And there's this one monologue. This is what made me think of it. And I gratefully people are trusting me enough to let me go a little bit too, because I also am a very good writer. Within my character, I really do have something. Hmm. And there was this one thing we took off on that is just great. I mean, it's as good as anything I've ever done. And I really mean that. And it's just, I don't know if anyone will ever see the film, what will ever happen with it. But I had that moment. Hmm. And you're elated. You know, it's real. It's the energy charge is spectacular.
It reminds me, Meryl Streep talked about that every role she took, she would create a secret for herself and never reveal it to anyone. And it sounds a similar thing. It's that thing that's just for you.
Yep.
And so it holds back some of the mystery, I guess, of the performance.
I'm glad you discussed her for a sec, too, because I was very fortunate when I lived in New York. I also worked with Uta Hagen and Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg. I'm a member of the Actors Studio. I mean, I am the real deal. I know I feel like saying meaning. I know how to work, and I cherish that I know that, and I'm using that word a lot, but it's the truth. And that's one of the things. Uta Hagen is textbook perfect. There's a book she wrote called Respect for Actors, and it's really this is what you do, and it's stuff about a secret. It's having something in your pocket that you feel. Anything that keeps you real. It's really about your own reality and being able to. And Strasberg, too, had this great exercise he once did at the Actors Studio with Harvey Keitel, actually, who was a pretty neat guy, actually. But
I guess that.
Very interesting guy. And listen, the studio was hotsy-totsy. I mean, it was Shelley Winters and Mark Rydell, God bless him. And he's still around, and I don't think he's directing anymore, but and Ellen Burstyn, and I mean, I was around heavyweights. Yeah. It was fun. I mean, you really listen and you pay attention. And he gave him this one exercise, and he had him just sit in a seat, and he said, and there was a monologue that he was going to do, and he said, "I want you to do the monologue like you're driving a car, and really like do it." Like put the key in the thing, you know, do the steering, stop at the red light, really create the whole thing, you know, and he said, do it big, do it broad. So Harvey started doing the thing and, you know, very kind of broadly. And then he said, okay, very slowly, just pare it down. Hmm. Just make it just a little bit. And so I don't remember how many times they did it, but sort of by the end of the monologue, he was doing, it was in his body. It was like steering the wheel and putting in the key and stepping on the brake. And turning the wheel without really turning it, and it was fascinating. It was fascinating. You never in a million years would have known that was an actor's choice to do that. But what it ended up creating was this incredibly visually interesting and emotionally interesting. Oh, because he said to him at one point, "Have to slam your brakes on because somebody's crossing the street." Mm. And so it's stuff like that. You've really got to use your own imagination to create your imaginary world. Mm. And within that, it's really complex, but so much fun. Within that, you're given real objects to deal with. And it's kind of mysterious because even when you think you know exactly how it's going to work out, it doesn't always work out like that. And sometimes you're disappointed and sometimes you're not. Sometimes you're surprised. But that thing about using things to create the world around you. Right. I'm always fascinated by, no matter how much I have it figured out in my head, and I have to work really hard on lines. I mean, I have a little program. I'm a visual learner. You can tell me anything from now until day after tomorrow, and I have to really pay attention to remember it. But physically, if I see something, I can, that stays in my head somewhat too. So, I know that when I'm working on something, I don't really know exactly what it will be, and this is right, until you're there and you're in the space. I didn't know there was going to be a bed there or pictures of my mom up on the wall. Or so suddenly you have to let go of everything you've thought of and you hope the residual part sticks because that's the core. But within that, you have to recreate the character almost at the end the moment. And I love acting. I really, really love it. It scares the shit out of me. Mm. I'm always scared to death.
How did you – because until you were coming on, I hadn't even put this piece together. One of my absolute favorite directors, and he's a genre director but not necessarily a horror director, Walter Hill. You're in all of his early movies.
Four of his movies.
How did that – what was that relationship? Because that's early in your career.
Okay.
Long Riders is the first one.
Okay. Yeah. Jimmy Keach, who I haven't seen in a bazillion years, when I was in New York, we did The Tempest. Sally Kirkland played Miranda. Yeah. I played Ariel. Jimmy Keach played both Caliban and Ferdinand back to back. And I became friends with them. We did it. Oh my God, that's probably the only Shakespeare I've ever really done. I'm terrified of Shakespeare. I don't understand it. I know it's terrible to say for an actress. I really don't. I don't understand it. I have to go back and read it so many times that it takes the fun out of it for me. So Jimmy Keach became a friend. I mean, because we rehearsed this thing, you know, for all these weeks, and then you do the show. And when I came out to Los Angeles, which is another story all unto itself, I had no intention to come out here. But I called everybody. I mean, that's my mom. I'm fearless. I don't care. They pick up the phone or they don't pick up. I'm calling. So Jimmy said, we're doing the Long Riders. He told me about it. And he said, I don't know if he asked me if I wanted to meet Walter, but I said, well, can I meet Walter Hill? You know, is there a part for me? That's always my first question. Is there a part for me in it? So he said, well, there's these prostitutes. Funny again.
Well, okay. Yeah. That's all I'm interested in, Lynn. I'm just charting your role.
I have played a lot of hookers.
Were you at least called prostitute in this one instead of whore?
No. Yeah. But anyway, I think he told Walter. I don't really know how the whole introduction actually happened. But I remember, Jimmy just said, come over. He was at Burbank. He said, come on over and meet him. So I remember I was wearing cowboy boots and these little cut-off jeans, shorts. I was really cute. I didn't think I was. But I actually was pretty cute. And I was wearing, I remember, this little black T-shirt with a tiger on it. It was a black and just a white outline of a tiger. And I went in and met Walter, and I guess on some level, you know, he was like, that's good, you know. Yeah, she had the chutzpah again to come in, and, you know, I was like all dressed up in my low cowboy boots. and he said there's these roles of, you know, and he hired me to play this prostitute. Mm. And it's a scene with Randy Quaid, actually. Mm. And it's in the movie. I mean, it's just me dancing with him. I don't even know if I have any lines, but it's me dancing with him. And I remember there's a moment where which was my idea. I think it's just a close up where I sort of have my eyes closed. He's either kissed me or I give him a little kiss. And then I kind of open my eyes and I'm really like, all right, what's next kind of thing. And so that's how I met Walter. And Brewster's Millions was just a little role. He would call me in. Hmm. And he's a wonderful person. I haven't seen him in a long time. I ran into him at an award show. I think it was at what's the one up in
the Saturns?
Yes.
Yeah. I think I was at the I met him at that. The only time I've ever seen him in person was there.
So. And I was very disappointed. It's almost like he didn't know who I was. And it was okay. I mean, but it was like, I'm like, well, you know, because I mean, Brewster's Millions, The Long Riders.
There's two other on there.
Extreme Prejudice with Nick Nolte.
Which is my favorite of his films, by the way.
It's a great one, actually.
Yeah, and not available, really.
There is one more, I think. Extreme Prejudice, but I can't remember what it is now either.
Yeah. You're in too many things, Lynn.
Yeah, there's a lot.
it starts to fade there.
Oh, boy. But
well, what's great is the love of acting shows throughout that career.
Yeah.
It's insane.
The story about this is, I mean, this is a, there's so many. Oh, my God. Yeah. It was crazy. But I was in New York. I had no intention of coming to L.A. ever. I mean, I wasn't interested in movies. I wanted to do theater. And primarily. And I had gotten a role in Candida, the play, the George Bernard Shaw play, with Eva Marie Saint playing Candida, and I got the role of Prossy, her secretary. It's a great play. And I auditioned for it, and I did a wonder. I knew I did a really good audition. I got the job, and we were going to do it at the Boston Rep Company in Boston. And I still have the notebooks where I did research on a woman in that time, whatever the time period is. I forget what the time frame is, but about wearing pants, like women didn't wear pants then yet, and that I wanted Prossy to be able to come in pants. I thought that was a good idea. So long story short, I get fired. We hadn't gone to Boston yet. We had barely started rehearsals. I don't think we'd started rehearsals even. And I was devastated. And I got a rash. And I had nothing happening. And I was just a mess. And I get a call from my agent. And he said, so Jack Nicholson was in town with Wally Nassida. No, Marion Doherty was the casting director, I think. For this movie they're doing, this cowboy, this Western they're doing, and he saw a picture of you and was interested in you for something. And so we sent him your picture and resume. And I'm going, what? Who is interested? And so I said, I'm available. I can come in and meet him. Yeah. And they said, well, he already went back to Los Angeles. They're not coming back to New York. So I ran around in circles. I went into my little doubt. I took every picture I could find of myself. You talk about naivete. This is me with curly hair. This is me with short hair. This is me with a wig. This is me in a hat. This is me with a bow in my hair. And I said, thank you, Mr. Nicholson. This note, thank you so much for your interest. And I just wanted to show you some other looks I have. I didn't know what else. And, there was a little card I had, and I remember the date was 7777, and I've had very major stuff with sevens in my life, both good and horrible. But this was 7777, and the card was soothsayer. It was a psychic card. And I thought, okay. So I put, and P.S., thank you for your interest, and I plan to be in Los Angeles for a short trip in the next couple of weeks. And I send it. And the next they get it. I send a special delivery because I don't even think there was FedEx yet in 1977. He called and said, I would love to meet Lynn as soon as she's in L.A. So I literally packed dirty laundry and I got on a plane the next morning. I got a fever blister on the plane. I could feel my lips swelling.
Oh, no.
Like Betty Buckley was out here already doing Eight is Enough. She was staying at the Chateau Marmont. So I called her because she was my singing acting coach in New York.
She's, no way.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. We became very good friends, actually.
And you were on Eight is Enough as well,
yep,
right?
Yep. That was partly from Betty. And so was Robin Williams in that episode, actually, which is weird. But so anyway, I called Betty. She said, oh, yeah, come on. I'll get you a room at the Chateau. So I'm going, I don't even know what the Chateau is, whatever. So I checked into the Chateau with a lip. And I'm not joking. It ended up being I had to have gamma-globulin shots. I had like – it was like a quadruple. Wow. It was horrible.
Oh.
And the thing is swelling and it's starting to really hurt. And I'm going – I'm pretending it's not there. I'm just going – I'm supposed to meet Mr. Nicholson the next morning at Paramount. I'd never been to L.A. I'd never been to a studio. I check into the bungalow that John Belushi lived in for many months, I guess. I found that out later. And I must have called the cab company 30 times to make sure they were coming at like 8:30. So I was going to be there at 9 for the thing at 9:30. And so we go to Paramount. And I mean, I'm walking through those gates. That was really the first time I ever had any sense of what Hollywood was. Because I didn't know it really – I didn't care, to be honest. But that was pretty grand. And so I go up to his offices with the fever blister. I remember I kept thinking if I put on a lot of mascara, I remember exactly what I was wearing. I was wearing this little see-through blouse with a little leotard under it, kind of that had a little floral thing on it and jeans and these little platform strappy shoes. I was all dressed up with the fever blister. And so I sit down, and Mary Steenburgen had just gotten hired, and which is another story. He picked her up. She was a waitress and sitting in the waiting room,
right.
And he basically had her come in and read and gave her the job on the spot. I mean, which was
cool.
That's him. That's who that guy is, too, by the way. So anyway, so they call me in, and I'm trying to pretend everything is fine. And I walk in, and there's Jack sitting at his desk with my pictures up on the bulletin board with those, you know, maybe four or five other actors. And he's got his head down. He's looking at my resume. He says, well, let's see here if there's anything we can talk about. And he looks up at me with that typical Jack Nicholson thing. He says, what happened to your mouth?
Oh, no.
And I said, oh, no, I didn't really just come out here to meet you. I said, I was really coming out. And I sort of just babbled and babbled. And he was so sweet. He said, well, these are for some small roles. He said, there's four spinsters. And he said, but we could make one a parasol lady. So, and that was it. The whole meeting lasted about, it felt like 30 seconds. I walked out. I went to the doctor. I was really in trouble with my mouth. So I go and I figure I'll stay, you know, I'll follow any of my connections. So I started calling people. It's the same thing. You know, hi, you know, casting directors were picking up the phone. I said, I came out here to meet Jack Nicholson. I go, you know, I made up this whole sort of profile, basically. Yeah. And then I was here for 3 days, and based on a tape I had, I got a job on a Universal Movie of the Week with Judith Light and F. Murray Abraham.
Oh, my gosh.
A guest star. I ended up getting a review in Variety. Oh, this was the other thing. I had never done a TV show, except for that Margaret Sanger thing. So I went shopping for my wardrobe. I got a little shirt that said hot stuff on it, literally. And I had it because she was supposed to be this little hotsy-totsy wife. And she's in the kitchen, you know, Uta Hagen. So what was I doing right before the scene starts? That's a big question you ask. So I'm in the kitchen, and F. Murray Abraham is calling to me, and I'm sort of calling from the kitchen. So I figure, what am I doing in the kitchen? I've got a turkey leg. I'm eating. So I come to the set. You know, I mean, I'm hired. I come to the set with my little palm tree earrings, my little T-shirt, and my turkey leg. And the director, I think it was Jack Arnold, who's like a really old-timer.
Yeah.
Incredible Shrinking.
Yeah. And who,
Creature from the Black
Lagoon. Yep. So here's all these seasoned TV pros. And I'm like, so here's my idea. So I'm in the kitchen and I'm eating this turkey leg. So when I come out, I've still got the turkey leg. And I had it from Nate Nals. Yeah. I brought my turkey leg.
That's so weird.
Right. And so and they're all standing there. Jack Arnold was sitting there with his arms folded, looking at me. And they used everything I brought in. It's in the. It's called Sex and the Married Woman.
Yeah.
It's still, you can watch it. And there I am with my turkey leg and my little T-shirt. And I got a really cute review in Variety. It was crazy. So then, and I didn't think anything had happened with going south. But then I literally got a call saying they want you in Mexico for 2 weeks. For this, the parasol lady.
Yeah.
And I still have the strawberry that was on my hat. It was the most, and John Belushi, Chris Lloyd, Veronica Cartwright, Danny DeVito.
It's a weird movie.
Yeah.
I saw that when I was going through my big Jack phase when I was young. I was like, whoa, he made this? Yep, what is this movie?
Yeah. And it was party land. I was never a part of any of it, but it was a big deal for me, you know, and I had a wonderful time, and he was very kind to me. And the best part for me was, because it takes place, you know, 1875 or something. And so we're all in period, these beautiful period costumes and horses, you know, all these fabulous animals, movie animals around. And Jack had this, a beautiful, I think it was like a big bay horse that he rode that was his for the movie, basically. And, After the two weeks were up, I didn't know whether I should wait, hang around a little. And Harry Giddes, who was one of the producers, comes over and he says, don't hang around. He said, say goodbye and go home. He said, that's what you should do. And he was right. You know, I mean, he said, what do you want to hang? You know, you did your job.
Yeah.
So he gave me very good advice. And I remember I just wanted to say goodbye to Jack. So Jack was in the distance, and I don't know if he knew he was coming back anyway, but suddenly this galloping image, I mean, with Jack on his on this giant horse, comes loping over and kind of like a car, you know, like doing a sliding stop practically in front of me. And I remember he just took off his hat. He said, "Thank you for coming." And he came over and he kissed me on the cheek. And he put his hat back on and took off. And it was really – and it changed my life.
I helped bring you out. When did you and your brother's career start to come
together?
That's
what I was going to ask, because it was like alone in the dark.
Okay, Bob Shea. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about Bob. My big brother.
Well, I was going to say, yeah.
How they come together.
Yeah, how they came together. Yeah, that's what I'm curious about.
Okay, but this is part of it.
Yeah.
Bob can be very gruff to his little sister. Yeah. That's part of the deal. And, but he is such a soft, loving guy, and who really did believe in me, even though he made me pretend. He'd always say, "This is my sister. She's an actress." That's how he would. "This is my sister, Linda. Wow. She's an actress." Yeah. And, oh, man, I would want to disappear into the woodwork. Really, it was horrible. But he's the one that would say to Wes Craven, "Put my sister in your movie."
Yeah.
And then he'd pretend it didn't happen. And then he would say to Pete Farrelly, "Put my sister in your movie." I mean, so all this stuff, a lot of this stuff, the Karina, there's a little role I had in that. I have all these little roles, but the big turning point was with Wes. And if it wasn't for Bob, I mean, I never, you know, it was total nepotism.
Yeah.
I mean, he would just say, "Put my sister in your movie." And these guys are going, "Okay." And even Jack Shoulder had a deal with, you know, "Put my sister in your movie." Yeah.
Did you have to prove yourself to those directors before they would go for that? Or was it like they blindly followed it?
No, they had a – and gratefully, I did a good job.
Yeah, they
and
got
actually,
lucky.
There's a really sweet story also having to do with Bob. When I got the call from to do Dumb and Dumber, Rick Montgomery was the casting director, and, you know – auditioning sucks. It's just so fucking hard. No matter how prepared you are, no matter how much you think you know you're going to, it's just impossible. It's for me anyway. I've had really good auditions, but it's just an awful, I hate them. I really have never enjoyed them. But so I got a call from Rick Montgomery, no audition. We'd like you to do a small role. We'd like you to do a scene in this movie, Dumb and Dumber, that New Line Cinema's producing, blah, 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 blah. And it shoots, I can't remember where we were, if we were in, but he said, you know, it shoots out of town. It's for one day. So I thought, oh, my God, okay, I was so excited. I didn't have to audition, and I had a role, a part. And Jeff Daniels was in it, and you know, and Jim Carrey. I didn't know him very much, but I knew Jeff Daniels for sure. And so I thought, oh my God! So I called Bob and I said, "Do I have you to thank for this?" He says, "Oh, get your own job." You know, and he kind of hung up on me almost. So I thought, I wonder, maybe someone saw my work in Karina. I had no idea. Okay, so. And I come, my Uta Hagen, I'm a woman who owns a French poodles and I get to a dog show. So I made them do me little curls, like real tight pom-pom curls in the front. And I said to Pete, and I meet Pete and I say, "Hi, how are you? It's nice to meet you." And Jeff was there and I was kind of intimidated because Jeff is Jeff. And I said, I was always confident about my idea, you know. So I had some ideas, and I said at the end of the little scene, she flings open the door and she's supposed to scream. And I said, "What if instead of screaming, you know, I said people are like their dogs, what if she whimpers?" Like, And Pete said, "Yeah, I like that. That's a good idea." So we shoot the scene, and I remember coming. I was just for the day, and I went. I asked if I could come to some of the dailies, and I walked in. I had long hair, actually, and Pete had no idea who I was. And when he was so blown away, he says, "That was you?" Hmm. You know, this Pete is. Pete is now Pete. He's now winning all the awards. And he said, "Oh my God, that was so great!" You know, and really thank you, and blah blah blah. So I went home. End of story. About a month later, I get a note in the mail from my brother. And it, I still have this on my desk to this day. And it says, for your scrapbook. So I open it up, and it's a note from Charlie Wessler, who's Pete's producer. And it said, dear Bob, usually when an executive of a company recommends a family member, we throw up. we would like them to do nothing better than to get them as far away as possible, he said. In your sister's case, she did such a great job for us. Thank you for sending her to us. And she did a fan. So Bob, you know, pretends he's this gruff guy, but he really he's been a huge asset in getting me opportunities.
And I assume Wes felt similarly that you did a better job than he would have expected.
Yeah, I mean, Wes, that the teacher's become. I mean, really,
yeah, that's a great thing.
And that was also. And Wes was so sweet. I mean, he was such a good guy. Oh man, there was no really nobody like him. A real gentle, brilliant musician. He was like a musician, and I think he was a musician. He played the guitar. I think he played classical guitar quite beautifully. But Wes was really the second job I ever got from Wes was a Twilight Zone.
And, oh, that's amazing.
And he brought me back for that, and at the audition. it was kind of an emotional little moment. And so when I finished the scene, the casting director, whose name will remain unknown, said, could you do it a little less sappy this next time? And I gave him the finger. And Wes, and I mean, it was just like, fuck you. And I didn't, you know, and Wes was in the, and I saw Wes just go. And he hired me. So Bob Shea has been a very important person, not just in everyone else's life in the film community, but in my life.
Oh, that's great.
I'm sorry, no, just because you brought up the Farley Brothers, and I know technically it's the horror podcast.
Oh, no.
But I love – it started with Dumb and Dumber, but I just love that they always found something – interesting and unique for you to do in all their movies.
They're tough. Boy, I had auditioned for the Kingpin story is insane.
But that's because it's their masterpiece. I love Kingpin.
And it's my masterpiece.
I think
my
Bill Murray in that is the funniest.
The funniest
he's
ever been. I agree with
you. He's so good in that film. His hair.
Okay.
Amazing.
This is truly, I knew that they were doing this because I saw a little thing in Variety. And so I wrote Pete a note because I had just done Dumb and Dumber. Mm-hmm. And I get no response. And I call their office, and I made friends with this guy, Pat Healy. Actually, the real Pat Healy, because they use his name in Something About Mary. But had become a friend, and he was an associate of Pete's. And he said, "Well, we'll see what we can do." Blah blah blah. He said, "I can send you the script." Just if you want, and he probably shouldn't have, but he did. And the character Mrs. Dumars is described as the angriest, ugliest woman God has ever let loose on the planet. And I thought, I've got to do this role. Yeah. I have to do this role. So I started calling. They're all ignoring me, totally ignoring me. We're almost at, they were starting principal photography. I knew, I didn't even know who else was in the movie. I really knew nothing about it. And for 6 weeks, since I knew about this, I sat and created this character. I bought that outfit at Aardvark's on Melrose. I put egg on my face to give myself a skin condition that was like yellowy. I put eyelashes coming out of my nostrils so I would have these big long nose hairs. I yellowed my teeth. I tore my fingernails apart. I put Mazola oil in my hair. I mean, I didn't know from latex yet. I was just sort of trying to make myself. And I came up with this, like, that she's a smoker and that she's got that voice. And I'm not joking. Every night I added another element and worked on the material, even though I didn't have an audition. Finally, it's like 5 days or so before they're starting photography. My agent was dead. My agent had died.
Oh, wow.
Oh my goodness.
I'm sitting at the table. I can't get an audition for this I'm obsessed, this obsession I have. And it was literally my ex-husband came in. He said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "Why don't you call, talk to one of the producers who you know." So Steve Stabler, it was Motion Picture Corporation of America, Steve Stabler, Brad Gravois, and Bradley Thomas, who since, you know, worked a lot with the Fairleys afterwards. But Steve was a friend, kind of. So I got him on the phone, and I said, "I'm trying to get I'd love to read for this character. And he said, Lynn, we love your work, but we really just don't think you're right for this. We have, you know. And I said, please, I've worked out this whole scene, you know, I've worked it all out. He said, and finally he said, okay, come on in on Thursday. So I dress up exactly as you see in the movie.
This is your outfit?
Again, it's pretty remarkable.
Becca's pulled you up.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that what we're talking about?
It's all coming back to me now.
What's the teeth? The teeth are what?
The writing is so brilliant also. Yeah. So I dress up. That was what I came in. And I came in, and there was no place to sit down. I was in – I have a little red Saab convertible. I get in my car looking like that. I drive. I'm afraid to be late, and I look. I catch my look in the rearview mirror, and I think I'm out of my fucking mind. What am I doing? And I just thought, I gotta go.
Yeah.
So I get there. I was late a little bit, so I pull into the parking lot next door to the building. I got out of the car. The parking lot attendant flung himself. I'm not joking. Against a brick wall. He almost –
revulsion?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
He just was like, what is that? And I just said – I said, I'm going in there for an audition. Don't worry about me. I won't hurt you. And I go in and I sit down and Rick – and they're ignoring me. I mean, Rick is walking by me and I'm going – and I'm kind of looking at my watch. I've been sitting there now for about a half hour and I was already a little late. Yeah. And I said, Rick – and he looks down. He said, Lynn? I said, yes. I said, I was late. I know. He said, I thought you were off the street.
Oh, my God.
He said, yes. I had no idea. That.
You so he full said, method.
So come on in. And I was so – I did the audition. I had no idea how I did. But I was just to do it finally, yeah. You know. And so – and Pete was – they were all like, what is that? And – and the next day, they called and told me I got the part. And they said there was nobody that could have touched that. And he said, bring your clown suit with you. So, and it's, I think, some of the best work I ever did.
Well, talk about a great lesson for people listening who are actors. Like, that is, you have to be a little crazy. Mm-hmm. That is crazy. Like, crazy. Some of the stuff you did was crazy, but look what it got.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I remember about that movie. I remember the landlady.
And so. Woody was fantastic.
He was so good.
Oh, my God. He was so, they were all so into, he was so into what I was doing too.
Yeah.
And that whole scene about breathe. He said, and he kept telling me to breathe. That's so funny. I mean, that was him, you know, that made that happen. And it was Pete's note when he said, I forget how the scene ends exactly, but he said, just give it like a little, that would be good. And it is. I think it's my favorite role I've ever had.
Yeah, that movie is so outrageously funny.
Well, I like that. I was going to say that. I like that there's like a kind of a period where you were, you know, working with Walter Hill, you were working with Jack Nicholson, you kind of eased into horror for a period, and then there was this kind of like comedic renaissance where you were able to exercise the tools you had for that, you know. I mean, like, I think you played a little bit with that and like in the Critters films and some other stuff, but you were able to fully embrace that, which was really cool.
I really love comedy, but I love acting. It doesn't, that's the whole thing. It's like there's no distinction for me finally. It's whether it's a horror film or a drama or comedy, it's again that stepping into the tornado. You have to.
Oh no! I had a question. Sorry. Okay. No. Do you miss doing theater, or do you still get to do theater occasionally? Because from like an actor's standpoint, theater is completely different. Where it's like one and done, and it's this giant buildup and a giant climax of doing it all and not fucking it up because people are already watching. Whereas film, it's a lot less. You don't have that kind of climactic urge with it.
It's such a different process. I haven't done. We had a theater company here when I did move out to LA finally. And I call a lot of people, I guess, in my, a lot of note writing and a lot of calling. But there, I met this guy, and I had readings of plays at my apartment, and we were always doing theater, and we started a theater company called the Los Angeles Theater Unit that we had for 10 years, actually. And so I did theater, you know, it was all original plays. And I haven't really done any theater since I did Tobacco Road with a friend. This was years ago, though, also. It's such a different process, and there's nothing like waiting backstage to go on stage. Mm-hmm. There's just nothing quite like it. It's not like being on camera. And the energy of the audience is very important. And it's a mistake when you start waiting for their response, especially if it's a comedy. But so I haven't done theater in a long time. Would I do it? I would. It's a lot of work, too. Mm-hmm. It's really hard work because you do, and then it's over unless you have a long run. The way my career is going right now, I wouldn't want to be taken out of, it depends. I don't know. You know, the answer is yes. The answer is always yes.
Well, you were a character actor for so much of your career, and then the fact that now you're turning into a leading actor, in fact, leading a franchise, which is remarkable. Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, I haven't looked in depth enough to know how many times you had been a lead before that in your career, but I mean that must be a big shift for you in terms of the approach to even a character because you're on screen so much more.
It's still charting the territory. I mean, really, that for me is what's sometimes missing in young writers is they don't finish the characters. Mm. You know, no matter how small it is, if it's one scene, there's got to be a beginning, middle, and end. Mm. And actually, Kingpin is one of the best written characters. You meet her, she's got attitude, she introduces herself, she falls in love, she's betrayed, and she has, she's betrayed, and then she has her
payback.
Yeah. Really. I think, finding the thread of the character is sort of the same, even if it's theater or film. Theater, you also, it's given me so much in terms of tools, because again, it's objects, it's an OODA. Muda. She was really using things. Suddenly, this gives you a whole nother, it gives you a whole nother life. You would never have if you didn't have something in your hand. Yeah. Mm. Maybe it cools you down. Maybe it's too cold or it makes you unhappy. I mean, there's so many details that living theater can give you. And then you find, and I used to, learning lines was a lot easier actually because it's all physical. It's like, I know on this one, I'm over at the table. Mm-hmm. That's where that section happens. And then there's another section over there. In film, it's quite different. You have to, and it's like you don't really know it until you're in it and doing it. And then you repeat it enough times that you finally, or for me, I finally get it, but.
Yeah, like theater, you can always go. It was almost like autopilot where I always knew that if I was walking over here that there were, I stopped thinking.
Right.
And something just happened and your body goes, it's like rote.
Totally.
Yeah.
We had a very good time though with our theater company. We built theaters. I mean, we had a theater in downtown LA at the old Embassy Hotel. We turned into a theater. We were at one of the American Legion halls for a while. We won a bunch of awards. We had some really wonderful, wonderful plays and stuff that we did. And we actually once on stage. This is the kind of thing that can only happen in theater. A homeless woman just walked on stage, came in through the set door.
Oh, jeez.
With a cup of coffee in her hand. and she said, "Is that the door out?" I said, "Yeah." So she turned around, went back out the door, the door to the set, ended up, and everybody in the audience thought it was part of the, of it. So there's surprises, going up on stage is quite an experience too, where all of a sudden you go, where am I? What's happening? We're in film, you can yell cut and start again or whatever.
Well, I'm getting the sense, you're still excited about the film process. You're still excited about the acting process. I'm looking at your IMDb Pro. There's like 10 films already in a pipeline.
Yeah.
So what's for you, how are you choosing the projects now? I mean, has that changed?
It's really three, story, mm-hmm. character, and people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's if it's a good story, that's what I was telling you about this little film, Get Gone.
Yeah.
I mean, it was to be honest, a nightmare experience. They didn't even know what a call sheet was. Mm. I mean, it was awful for me, that part of it, because I'm very structured when I work. I mean, really, I like, by the minute, I need to know, you know, what time the car's coming, what time I got to get in the car to get to where I'm going, or when there's no, you know, what time am I starting tomorrow? I don't know. We'll know tomorrow around 10.
Oof.
I'm going, well, what, you know, how do I, what do I do? You know, how do I? So that was a nightmare. But what made me take the job was the story and the writing. I liked the character. I thought the character. So those are the same criteria. Money is not a criteria for me. I mean, I love getting paid a lot of money. Don't get me wrong. And I mean, my agents and finally won't let me. They won't let me totally.
Yeah.
If I fight for it because I say I got to do it, I really, then they say, then just go do it, you know, whatever. But it's really people, you know, and story.
Do you still get scared at all? Like, especially, I would say, taking on, say, maybe Insidious 3, when you're first going from the character actor to the lead, was there any fear? Or I mean, it seems like you've largely been fearless, but.
Not so much fear as.
Well, three as well.
Four.
Three. You become
She's
the main.
Kind of the lead in three.
Yeah, you are the lead.
Well, I always feel like four is like
no, the purely.
But three is where it went away from the other two characters and said, you are the character.
You
are the franchise.
What was hard for me is it was exhausting.
Yeah.
Because usually you work a week and then you're off for a little bit, and you come back for a few days, or you do 10 days, or you do 2 weeks, whatever. But this was, 6 days a week, pretty much. Every day, I think there were only 3 days I didn't work the whole shoot.
Mm. And you're being directed by an Australian, which is horrible. A painful experience, I'm sure.
And the thing, and it was, I was exhausted. Mm-hmm. I was physically just emotionally wiped out because also the stakes in the film were so high all the time. That was mostly in the fourth one that I was on almost all the time.
Yeah.
The third one, they had a little bit of a break and stuff. But, you know, it's just figuring it. It's everything has its challenge, I guess. I really do love it. I love it. I love it. And then I love when I have a break, too.
Yeah.
Like this has been some time now. I did a bunch of films this last year. There's a film I co-produced called Room for Rent that I'm really excited about.
Tony Stovall, right?
Yeah.
He's done a couple of other horror films.
Yeah, and I've worked with him. Mm-hmm. And it got bought by Uncorked, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to figure out now to do some kind of a theatrical run either at the Cine Lounge or, because they're going to release it, you know, I guess on all the other venues and stuff. It's one of the best things I've ever done. I'm really proud of the work. And again, I got very involved in storytelling and in moving the character around, and Tommy was very supportive. He's a good guy. So that's coming, that's going to be released. Then there's this, Final Wish, which opened at Scream Fest, that's having a big, I guess they do like this one night thing. It's again Uncorked. I mean, it's a whole different kind of distribution.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they do a really good job. And so that's going to open, and then, oh my God, then there's Gothic Harvest, which I'm not sure what they're going to do with this. Chris Coben is producing it, and that's coming out at some point. I mean, there's so it's going to be sort of that kind of, you know, that there's Anderson Falls, which is this film I did that Luc Barnett produced with this French director who is really wonderful. That I think is going to be a really, it's a thriller.
So there's a lot more Lynn to come on the big screen.
Yay. I hope. And, you know, and listen, you know, the whole woman thing, getting old is weird. I have to tell you, it's really weird because I don't know where it is. I mean, I don't know what that means. Other people seem to know what it means. But I don't, and I kind of don't buy into it. You know, I mean, I know, I think there is something about feeling ageless and genderless in terms of what I have to offer. Mm. Now, I know, of course, with character, you know, it's not like saying I'm going to play a 30-year-old ingenue, but I hope that without my limitations on myself, that I really work until the day I die. Mm. I really want to do it. I want to just keep, and I feel I always have something to contribute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, that's what
well,
I
that's
hope.
Inspiring.
That's great.
So,
I think the story that you told tonight that I just assumed that once you worked with the Farley brothers, they just offered you cool, quirky roles.
Everything, yeah.
Oh,
so
no.
I think that's probably the most valuable lesson tonight. A lot of people, whether they're writers, directors, actors, they ask once and kind of give up.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the fact that you fully walked in with that character that we remember, like you didn't give up. You were convinced that that was what it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's something valuable in that. Like, if you really believe in the quality of what you're doing, there's got to be a way to make it happen.
And it's not even, to be honest, though, it's not even believing in the quality of what I'm doing. It's doing it. It's like, what does she look, what, you know, somebody that's the angriest, ugliest woman that God ever, I mean, what a fabulous description. Yeah. How can you not want to play that? And I remember thinking, what does her skin look like? Well, it's got to be all scaly and weird, like a lizard, you know, and smoking, all that smoking, and you got to have a little emphysema going.
Yeah.
You know, so it's again going to the details of the character that give you the that give you the details of the performance. So and I honestly am as scared. I'm always scared. I'm always terrified. I'm always terrified, and it's like I'm not going. I don't want to do it. and I'm a little bit agoraphobic, I think. Mm. I honestly do, because now that I haven't been working, you know, these last few, this couple months, I have a horse, so I ride and I do all that. I do stuff. But boy, I love my home, and if I don't have to go talk to anybody, I'm so happy to do it. And yet I know that ends up being bad for me ultimately, and that, as is clear by this, that I haven't shut up for 30 seconds in this whole interview. Yeah. I guess I have a lot to express.
Yeah.
And, I love humanity. I hate people, but I love humanity. I'm so mad at people right now. Yeah,
I understand.
Oh completely. My God. What is, and I mean, I am have this, the thing about the getting old part where I really remember when it was better than this. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I think a lot of it is this, the technology has taken people, the heart out of people.
Yeah.
They're not paying attention to each other. They're only paying attention to their thing and themselves and it's not going fast enough, and it's like people are belligerent. Yeah. Didn't used to be as bad as that.
Yeah.
So as an artist, I feel it's all of our responsibility to listen to each other, to offer up every idea we have and every inspiration we can utter, and to love, really, without being corny, really love and appreciate each other and the interior growth that we all are capable of.
Yeah.
Well, it's beautiful.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Thank you so can't much, that.
I'm trying to think of a way to ruin this moment.
No. You just did, Elric.
Elric can't be snarky. Those two gorgeous.
I think I just was.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my God.
Lynn, we love you on behalf of not just everyone in the room, but everyone listening.
Yes.
We do.
Yes.
We adore you, and we thank you.
Oh, thank you. So this was really a treat for me. Now I can get a good night's rest.
All right, thanks, guys.